Bing Crosby, welcome to the first program in our series on the Crosby years. I think this is going to be a fascinating venture for me, and I think you're going to find some surprises as you listen to it.
Well, I'm pleased to be a part of the venture. It sounds most interesting, all the ground you propose to cover. I hope I'm able to supply something useful.
Well, your memory's pretty good, isn't it?
No, my powers of recall are atrophied in advancing years.
Oh, now.
Sure.
No, I've heard you, I heard you on the David Frost show pulling things out of the past like there's no effort at all.
Well, it's tough. If you can, ask questions that will clue me into something, then I can probably remember.
Well, I want to get the first show underway with... I'd like to get it underway with the first song you ever recorded. Do you remember what that was?
As a single or...
As a single.
I made some records, duet. And I think the first song I ever recorded as a solo must have been with Paul Whiteman.
Well, there's one song title that has come to me that was recorded in 26 called I've Got the Girl with Don Clark and the...
But that was a duet.
Oh, that was a duet.
With Al Rinker.
Oh.
My partner.
Yeah.
We came down to Spokane together and went into vaudeville there.
Then your first solo was with Whiteman.
I think so.
Would that be Mississippi Mud?
No, that was with the Rhythm Boys. This was a band record and the vocal chorus. I think it was probably a song called Muddy Waters or...
Oh.
It might have been... something from Showboat. He recorded the score of Showboat, which was released about that time, and I had a couple solos, Make Believe, I think, an Old Man River.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll pick out one of those to get the show on the road today.
That'll do it.
Bing, you were born in Tacoma and raised in Spokane,
and
so you're sort of part of this whole area in which we live in the Pacific Northwest.
That's right.
And what sort of a childhood did you have? Was it pretty much like everybody else, growing up playing sports, baseball,
oh, yes.
And that sort
all
of
the normal pastimes. Of course, this is in Portland, aren't we?
Yeah, we're in Portland.
Well, my great-grandfather came around the Horn with his ship and landed in Portland, and he established a ship chandlery store there with another fella, right where Ladd and Tilton's Bank is now.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and then he cruised between there and China.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whatever happened to the ship chandlery store. I think his partner sold him out and skipped or something. He was in Hong Kong.
Somebody may have skipped.
So I have started an affinity for Portland, too.
Well, I know you do, and have had that background there. Your mother had a great deal of influence on you in your early days.
Was interested in singing. My father played guitar, and they both appeared in amateur musicals, Gilbert and Sullivan things. And she kind of pumped me up every once in a while and took me to a teacher one time when I was about 10 or 11. I didn't last long there, though. The boys were kidding me about taking singing seriously. They thought it was sissy. So I didn't stick with the teacher long, but he gave me some good hints, some clues, which I think have been helpful.
Well, while you were growing up, you played baseball. I saw a picture
every
of you
game,
baseball.
Every game. I played them all. Handball, baseball, basketball, football. I never was very good at any of them, but I was a participant, a very zealous participant in all branches of sport. Grade school, high school, up through college.
Well, Bing, you went to Gonzaga High School, and that sort of prepared you for Gonzaga University, and you were going to study law, but something happened.
Well, I was working in the law office part-time, the Great Northern Railroad Law Office, and I had this little band down there. I was a member of this little band, and we were playing around town in different places and different functions and dances out at the lakes on weekends, and I discovered after 6 or 8 months in the law office there that I was making more money than the lawyer I was working for. So I figured, well, the law isn't for me. I think I can do better than this. I wouldn't have made much of a lawyer anyhow.
Well, I don't know.
No, it takes a lot of work and a lot of zeal, and I didn't have that for the law.
Well, I'm glad you didn't, frankly, because I think you've given a great deal to the entertainment world that we certainly have enjoyed for so many years. When you were in school, did you take part in drama or any of that sort of thing?
Well, like all Jesuit schools, they had a very active elocution and debating program. I was on the debating teams from freshman year in high school on, and they used to have elocution contests. They'd run through the year, they'd have eliminations, and finally get down to the finals, which was for the public, and we used to recite all the Robert W. Service poems, and Alaska, and Whispering Jim, and Civil War poems, and there was a gold medal for the first, and a silver for second, and a bronze for third, and I took part in all of those I could get in, and I don't remember if I ever won a gold medal or not. I think I might have picked up a ribbon or something else in there, but I knew all those poems, and it was good training. epic elocution, because those poems were epic poems. They told a story, and you had the opportunity to act a little bit. And if you could do it well, you were successful. That was very good training. And the Debating Society was good training, too. We had a lot of that.
I'd like to have seen you do Face on the Barroom Floor.
Oh, I did that very well. Spell of the Yukon and Whispering Dan McGee and, all those things we did. Well, Spartacus at the Bridge. They had a whole glossary of things that we did. They're very dramatic, most of them. The Duke-Eyed Snake and Lasker. Old-timers might remember some of those titles.
I remember some of those titles. I don't like to call myself an old-timer.
No, you're a young man. Just a sprout compared to me.
I don't know about that. getting to music, the Juicy Seven was a small group you worked with before you got into the Musicolators.
I think we had a knockabout group we called the Juicy Seven, but it wasn't a very long-lived. We formed the Musicolators and made it a formal group, and we stuck together for a couple of years around there.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I was, not in the meantime, but I got a job at the Clemmer Theater in Spokane. I have silent pictures, and I used to sing a song with the organ before the picture started. It would generally be a song that would have something to do with the type of picture that was on the screen. If it was a sea picture, I'd sing a sea song. Western, I'd sing a Western song. Anything that we thought would be appropriate or that seemed to fit the picture that was being screened.
I see, and that sort of built up a backlog of musical knowledge.
Yeah, I used to stand down by the organ, and they'd hit me with a amber spot, and I'd go into my ditty.
You told, I recall, Bing, you told David Frost when you were on his program, and I think that was in 1971, that you were celebrating 50 years as a paid performer. In other words, 50 years since apparently you got your first shekels for singing or something.
Yeah, I think it was between 49 and 50, and I wasn't quite sure, but yeah, I think I may have been a little premature. It's certainly 50 now.
It is.
Yeah, I'm unable to really fix the exact date when I get paid, but I'm sure it's 50 years now.
What do you consider your first professional performance?
I can't remember what it was, unless it was with the band, the Musicolators. I can't remember whether I was at the Clemmer Theater before or after the Musicolators. But it was right in that period, like 25, 26.
Mm-hmm. And that led to Al Rinker and Mildred Bailey, mm-hmm. who was his sister.
His sister, and who lived in Spokane.
Mm-hmm. And she took you to Mike Lyman, as I recall, Lyman's brother, and that sort of started things moving with Whiteman.
Well, we had a duet then, Rinker and I, and we played the cafe for a while, the Tent Cafe, and then we went on the road for Fanchon and Marco. And they used to have a circuit that ran from San Diego all the way up to Seattle, I think, and we played all the dates for a year or two. And we were in Los Angeles playing the Metropolitan Theater, and Whiteman was in town with his band playing the Million Dollar Theater. He contacted us and asked to join him in Chicago, which we did.
Mm, and that was the start of your association with him.
With Whiteman. And then after a year or two, he put Harry Barris with us, and we formed a group called the Paul Whiteman Rhythm Boys.
Which, of course, is still a famous group today. I remember on Whiteman's memorial program, or not a memorial program, but a program he did, you all got back together again.
Yeah.
Recall some of the older mm-hmm. songs. Bing, did you ever record anything duet-wise with Ben Burney?
Not that I remember, no.
Because there's a song chasing around, It All Depends on You is the name of it, which...
I can be happy, I can be sad, I can be happy. It all depends on you.
Right.
I sang that a lot, but I don't know if I ever recorded it.
This was a duet record, and there's been a question, and I just wondered...
That's
because
where I must have sang with the band somewhere, because that's where I first met Oscar Levant. He was the pianist with Ben Burney.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
A number of top singers were around at the time you were commencing your singing career, Bing. Of course, in 1927, it was Gene Austin. He had the big one.
In Blue Heaven.
Million Seller in Blue Heaven.
He had some others, too, but that was the one I recall.
Yeah.
Well, there wasn't nearly the competition there is now, John G.
Oh, well.
If I had to start now, I know I'd probably never get anywhere. There's millions, well, thousands, let's say. Good singers, good groups, good soloists, good instrumentalists. Absolutely fantastic, the amount of talent that this new vogue has brought out.
Well, did Jolson, for example, or Benny Fields, who was around at that time, or any of, or Gene Austin influence you at all? You have influenced so many singers. Were you influenced by
any? Oh, I'm sure I was, yeah, particularly by Jolson. I imagine style, phrasing I picked up from him, and Benny Fields, and from Austin, and Ukulele Ike, Cliff Edwards. Those are some of the ones I remember. And just unconsciously, you adopt some of their mannerisms, some of their style. I'm sure I did.
Well, Bing, we're at the end of the first show, and we've covered a lot of territory today. We did want to get the background in, sort of, and we're going to be back next week with more, so I trust you'll join us.
Sure, I'll be available.
We'll be back right after Bing sings. Bing, it's 1929 and 1930 for our second show of the series. Do those dates raise any particular memories with you?
Well, you mean chronologically?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You're really putting me to the test here. 1929 and 30, I was in the Coconut Grove with the Rhythm Boys. Mm-hmm. We'd left Whiteman then, and we were with Gus Arnheim's band. Also in the band was Russ Colombo, and also Eddie Bush and his trio. It was quite an entertaining unit. There was lots of singers, lots of instrumentalists. It was an all-star aggregation. We put out good evening's entertainment. I believe at that time that we had a radio outlet, too, MJB Coffee or some coffee. And I think the radio outlet reached up in the Pacific Northwest. And we used to have a session during a dance break where we'd go up into a studio up above the bandstand and fake a lot of songs, sing a lot of songs with piano only and do some dialogue. And that was good training.
You mentioned Russ Colombo. Was he singing the band
and,
at the same time?
Play the violin. He was a violinist. He sang certain songs, I sang some, the Rhythm Boys sang some, the Eddie Bush group sang some, had everything going.
Well, let's get something going right now with you, Bing. Bing, you get back to Whiteman for a moment. You worked with some, what were then fabulous and later legendary musicians, people like Bix Beiderbecke and the Dorseys and
Eddie Lang
and Venuti. Mm-hmm. Did you have the feeling then that... they were legends. Were they legends in their time?
They were to me, yes, because I'd heard about them before I joined the band, and I followed band music even when I was back in Spokane. We used to wait outside Bailey's Music Shop for the new records to come in, the Mound City Blue Blowers, and the original Dixieland Band, and the Memphis Five, and the Cotton Pickers, and Gene Golkett's band, had Tommy and all those boys. So those names were legends to me, and... it was a great experience to be associated with him in the Whiteman Orchestra.
Goldcat, whose name doesn't come up very often today, was one of the big bands around, and Irv Aronson and some of the others in those
just
times.
Full of fellows who became legendary. Goldcat's band.
But while you were with Whiteman, Bing, you began your movie career on a rather tenuous basis. As I remember, this picture was the King of Jazz.
Yeah.
And something happened on the way to the set.
Well, it was done for... I think you're speaking of something that happened on the way from the party.
Oh, from the party,
yeah. We were larking about the bandsmen in those days. We had lots of time to ourselves, and I got a few drinks in me, and I was taking a young lady home, and a fellow hit me from behind in a Ford. I was in a Chevrolet, and she fell out of the car, and I took her in the Roosevelt Hotel to minister to her injuries, and the police came by, and they said, "You've been drinking?" And I said, "Yes," and they locked me up.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the fellow hit me was drunker than I was. I didn't think I was drunk. I was, had enough composure to carry the lady into the hotel and call the ambulance and so forth. But they said, "You had been drinking," and I said, "Yes." And the same thing occurred in the courtroom 2 weeks later. The judge said, on the complaint here, it says you had been drinking. I said, "Yes." He said, "Don't you know this prohibition law?" I said, "Well, nobody pays much attention to it." He said, "Well, you'll have 30 days to pay a lot of attention to it." Clang.
Well...
the door. And there I was.
Didn't that sort of cut you out of the picture?
No, I got moved out to Hollywood the last part of my term, and Whiteman was able to arrange to have a policeman bring me out to set every day, but I did miss a solo.
Song of the Dawn
or something of John Bull's saying, but we still did the songs we were scheduled to do with Rhythm Boys, Mention the Park and something else.
One of the great songs in that picture was It Happened in Monterey.
Yes, great song.
Which is, of course, the scene of your... golf classic every year.
By Mabel Wayne, who wrote all those marquitas and all those famous waltz Spanish hits so big in those days.
Bing, did you do some shorts for Pathé with called 2 Plus 4s and Rip Stitch the Tailor one of the college boys with Rinker and Barris?
Yep, those are a couple of shorts that we made while we were at the Golden Grove. I also did a couple for the Christie Brothers solo, and then 6 for Max Sennett. That was without the Rhythm Boys. But we used song titles. I used I Surrender Here for one. So on.
And then came Reaching for the Moon, which was Doug Fairbanks Sr.,
yeah,
which
I
played a cameo.
I had a song and a picture of Phillips Holmes and Philip and Sylvia Sidney were featured in this picture. I had just a song called, a picture called Confessions of Bacoid. I don't remember the song. No.
I have a recording of the song you did in the Fairbanks picture.
Yeah, Reaching for the Moon.
No, it was
when the high ups do the old lowdown.
Yeah, know? Something like that.
Yeah, well, I can't remember the song in Confessions of Bacoid.
Well, of course, then you went with Gus Arnheim to the Coconut Grove.
Yeah, that's right.
Bing, 1929 was the year you met Dixie Lee.
And, yeah, right about that time, 28 or 29. No, I guess it must have been 29, 30.
And then you married her. And she was a bigger star than you were.
At the time, she sure was.
You referred to the fact that one of the papers said movie star weds Bing Crovney or something.
Bim Crovney. Yeah.
Well, that's...
kind of a putting down.
Yeah, that's kind of... That must have made you feel real great.
No, I didn't mind at all. I was having fun.
Well, Bing, that wraps up show number 2. Will you join us next week and we'll see what happens next?
Mm-hmm.
Bing, today the years are 1931 and 32, and this was when you really began to get going as a radio performer, and when your
yeah, I was back east then. Mm-hmm. My brother Everett, who was handling my business, arranged to have some records sent to Bill Paley, who was the president of CBS at that time, still is, I guess. And I think it was I Surrendered Here, Rapid Troubles and Dreams, a couple of titles like that. He liked them, and I left the Coconut Grove then and went on back and went on sustaining on the CBS network, which later led to a sponsored program with Carl Fenton's orchestra called the Cremo Cigar Program. And then I played the New York Paramount at the same time for about 29, 30 weeks. And then I went on tour, took Eddie Lang and Lenny Hayden as the basis for my accompaniment, used the house orchestra on the RKO circuit, played all around through the East. And then I came out and made a picture called Big Broadcast.
Yeah, that came in there. That first program of yours, Harry Von Zoe was your announcer.
Was he?
Yeah, and he had to announce on the first program that you were not able to appear.
No,
I lost some union problems.
No, I lost my voice completely. Oh. I rehearsed a lot. And I guess I've been going up to Harlem every night to hear all the bands up there, and we get enough rest, and the pipes just gave out, and I got the afternoon rehearsing, and I couldn't produce hardly a sound. It was just hoarse, tired, and I think they canceled the first night. I don't remember, but for a couple nights.
Well, I have a tape of the first broadcast, at any rate, and we're going to play that for openers. Bing, we discussed the fact that Russ Colombo was in the band with you and Abe Lyman. You had another... Gus Arnheim.
Gus Arnheim.
Talking about, pardon me.
Abe Lyman was that band, too, and Mike Lyman was an agent.
Right. So Columbo sang. You had somebody else who was singing around that period of time named Rudy Vallee.
Yeah.
And do you recall a record somebody wrote called Columbo, Crosby, and Vallee?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear the song? Did they play it quite a bit?
Yeah. I don't know. I think I might have used it on the radio program. I don't know, but I certainly remember the song.
Well, you were the big three then, I guess.
Did I get first billing,
Crosby, Columbo, and Vallee? I think it was more...
First billing.
It wasn't exactly alliterative, but it bounced along at a good pace.
It rolls.
The big broadcast of 1932, being the one that really launched your film career and had a number of still famous radio names in it. Burns and Allen, of course.
Boswell.
Yes,
Mills
Boswell's.
Brothers.
Mills Brothers.
Pete Singer.
And some great songs.
Kate Smith, Morton Downey.
Yeah. Here Lies Love.
Star-loaded.
Please.
Was Here Lies Love in there?
Yeah. Here Lies Love. And, of course, Please, I guess, was the big one, wasn't
that
it?
That was the big one,
that made the hit. Let's listen to it. 1932, Bing, was the year you first met a man that you traveled many a road together with. I think it was at the New York Paramount.
Hope.
Around the same bill.
No, I was at the Capitol. I was playing the Capitol Theater that week. Yeah, Hope was on the bill doing an act with a girl. Very desultory type of act. No, it was good. It was a good act. He didn't have so much dialogue then. It was sort of a semi-song and dance act.
Mm-hmm.
About number 2 on the bill.
Did you ever talk in those days about maybe doing a picture or something?
No. I had no idea. Our paths would ever cross again. He belonged to the Friars Club, so did I, which was an actor's hangout. And I'd seen a lot of them even before then, and afterwards, of course.
Yeah, made famous. Next week, Bing goes to college. We'll talk about that.
All
and
right.
Does that sound interesting to you?
Oh, colorful.
Well, I think we'll see you back here then. Bing, this week we're going to talk about the years 1933 and 1934, and you started to make an awful lot of movies a year at this point. You had three going for you. There
mm-hmm.
were College Humor, which takes you to college,
yeah.
and Too Much Harmony,
mm-hmm.
and Going Hollywood. And it was my impression that some of the best music in films was written for those three pictures, some of the best things you did in those early years.
College Humor had the Olox Road.
Well, they had Going Hollywood. You had
Going Hollywood.
Temptation
and Take Me with the Daisies. Our Big Love Scene. A lot of good songs.
Yeah. And
Too Much Harmony had Thanks in it, I think.
Yes, Thanks.
Good.
And The Day You Came Along. And The Day You Came Along.
Oh, that was a good song, yeah.
But then this was one of the pictures, I think it was College Humor, in which you started giving lessons on the Boogie
Learned
style.
Learned to Croon.
Learned to Croon.
A song in there, right.
Yeah. When did you?
What was the ballad in there?
The ballad
Here
in
I Love?
In College Humor?
Yeah.
No, it was I'm trying to think.
To have a ballad.
Yeah, I know you have to have
I
a ballad.
Can't remember what it was. That was a good score. Nice picture too. Yeah. I think.
When did you first start the Boo Boo stuff?
Oh, that was way back. That was before all this that you're speaking of now. It even when I was with Rinker, we used to do a scat chorus. I'd hum a chorus, first part of the second chorus, kind of hum, and then it'd come and go boo boo boo, boo boo boo, and all, or whistle. Mm-hmm. Anything to fill up the first half of the second chorus, so you'd have to change of pace.
Did you ever use it for forgetting lyrics?
Oh, lots of times. It's very, very convenient.
Well, of course, I think one of the great songs of that period was Temptation, and that has remained quite a standard. Even
great song,
now.
Yeah.
So I'd like to listen to it.
Arthur Freed and Osseo Brown.
In 1934, Bing, you had a picture with Carol Lombard and an affectionate bear.
Yeah, We're Not Dressing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That had
I
a
think Ethel Merman was in that, and Burns and Allen.
Yeah.
I forget who else.
Well, the bear sort of stole the show, yeah.
Yeah, it was Petty Larson.
Was it the bear to whom you sang Good Night, Lovely Little Lady?
Uh-huh. Good night, lovely little lady, yeah.
That had a nice score to it, too. And then in 1934 came She Loves Me Not with Kitty Carlisle.
Mm-hmm. Love and Bloom, the song in there.
That's the one.
And he took that and made it his theme song.
Right.
He took umbrage at that.
Well, he doesn't.
In a nice way.
Well, Benny once said at a news conference that he didn't particularly like the song because it didn't make any sense. What's a comedian doing with Love and Bloom?
Uh-huh.
And,
it's a good melody, I guess. It's easy to remember. Lovely song. I think it's Ranger and Robin. They wrote some marvelous things.
Bing, with you made a couple of pictures with Kitty Carlisle, who was quite a singer in her own right.
Yes. And, later married Moss Hart.
Yeah.
Theatrical impresario.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who was connected with George Kaufman in some very big hit shows in Broadway.
Next session, Bing, we're going to talk about a man who is quite a legendary figure in films. He's been gone for quite a while, but he's had a neat resurgence today, and that's W.C. Fields.
Mm-hmm.
So if you'll be with us next week, we'll discuss him and some of your other films.
I'll be available.
The years are 1935 and 36 today, Bing, and by now you were spawning many imitators, the young Perry Como and Dick
Cannon. Was he around that
others.
Soon?
Yeah, he was.
As
a matter
later.
Of fact, he sang a song on the Burns and Allen program. No, the Fibber McGee and Molly program that sounded more like you than you did.
Love to hear that. Might have been all right.
Well, I'm going to play it. You'll have a chance before the program is over.
Good.
Right now, we're going to start with one of your songs of that period. Bing, as I started to say, many stars were beginning to imitate you, but I think the one who had the most interesting one was a man named Will Rogers, who in a picture called Judge Priest said that there were not... Crooners never lived to be very old, he said, and so he was going to show that there could be some old crooners And he sang Where the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. And I sent you a tape of that, and you wrote about an anecdote. At the time he died, they wanted you to sing...
Well, I was up in Saratoga, New York, at the races up there, and they had a big dinner party for the turf riders. And there was a good deal of potables available, lot of drinking took place, and I didn't skip any drinks that were passed around. And I arrived at the Arrowhead nightclub there in Saratoga, and I was well juiced, I guess, having a good time, and came over the radio. The Guy Lombardo was playing there, I think, and he had a radio outlet there every night. Came over the NBC network that Will Rogers had just been killed up in Alaska with Wiley Post, and they were putting together a memorial program, picking up people from all over who could do things in tribute to Will Rogers, and they wanted me to sing Home on the Range.
I was going to have to do it in about 10 minutes.
I was a little shaky from the sauce and from the realization that it was a solemn occasion, and it was a song that he dearly loved, and they thought it would be one that should be used. I couldn't remember the words, and I kept, time was drawing closer and closer, and I kept asking him if anybody knew the words. I knew the first line, of course, give me a home. And all of a sudden, I'm on the radio, and that's the first time I really had flop sweat. My palms were wet, my brow was damp, and they were playing the introduction, and there I was. I was, had sobered up a little by that time. And I sang the first line, thinking all the time, what the hell is the second line? And it came. And then what's the third line? And it came, and it just kept coming until I was finished. And I was really finished after that. I went right home, lied down.
Yeah, I think you said in your description to me that you were in intensive care for a couple of weeks after that one.
I was really scared and frightened. I didn't want to louse up a solemn affair like that.
Bing, you made Mississippi, which was about as close to Old Man River as I think you got in films, and one of your co-stars was W.C. Fields. There must be some fantastic stories about Bill Fields that you can remember. Did you share many of his fabulous, famous martinis?
Well, he lived right near me over at next to the Lakeside Golf Club. We played a lot of golf together. Not a lot, but every once in a while we'd get in the foursome together, and he was always a lot of fun. Of course, I was a fan of his, as everybody was. They all appreciated his humor. He was making short stand out of the Senate. And a lot of the people who worked with him at that Senate belonged to the club. I can't think of anything specific about Bill Fields, any specific episode or incident that would be amusing. He was just a funny guy to be around. He was full of gags and jokes. And he was a juggler, you know, and on the golf course, he always had a couple of golf balls going or a couple of clubs. Something. He was very good with his hands, very dexterous.
You played golf with him?
Mm-hmm. And I used to go over his house once in a time. Once in a while, he had a
house right on the lake. There's a little lake there called Toluca Lake, and there was a lot of big swans in the lake. I remember one day he was juggling a lot of glasses, and these swans started hissing.
Mm-hmm. And he stopped and said, "Critics."
Well, he was, you know, he's come back today with a young set. They enjoy him in the
kind of kept. There's been a vogue for him all through the years.
Yeah,
though he's been dead a long time.
You did
a lot of imitators, still imitate him, you know.
Bing, you did another big broadcast in 1936. Again, Burns and Allen, and there was Ethel Merman and Bojangles Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Oakey and Skeets Gallagher were two guys that showed up in a lot of those early films with you.
They were contract employees at Paramount at the time, and they put Jack in for everything, and Skeets too. They were light comedians. Jack was a little more of a heavy comedian than Skeets, a little broader. Jack was a very good performer. Very good, very funny. Good timing. Good, cute face.
Yeah, he's sort of... in retirement now, I
guess. Yeah, he's around Hollywood. Gotten very, very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
He appears at functions now and then. Has a good time.
Bing, one of the big pictures of this period was Pennies from Heaven,
mm-hmm.
in which you sang, of course, that particular song.
Yeah.
And that also had a fine score. But here you were making 3 or 4 pictures a year. How did you have time to do anything else?
Well, they would each take, you know, with rehearsals and everything, about 2 months apiece, that's all. So he still had 6 months.
Did you ever feel you were
getting... So in those periods, I was generally out playing theaters when I wasn't making pictures, or I was playing golf, or I was fishing or hunting, or doing something I wanted to do.
Did you ever feel you were being overexposed at that time?
No, I didn't. That wasn't too much. They were important pictures. By important, I mean they cost some money, and there was some thought and some production value that went into them, so I think it advanced my career more than anything else.
Well, Bing, that winds up our show for today. We'll be back next week with more from Bing, and we'll be covering a couple of more years of a fabulous career. Are you enjoying this?
Oh, yeah.
Wait till you hear it all put together.
Mm-hmm.
Bing, 1937 and 38 brought us Blue Hawaii and introduced another of your durable songs in Sweet Leilani, and probably had a great deal of influence on tourism in the islands.
Well, tourism was going pretty good then. That's where I heard the song. I was a tourist over there and heard it played by some local group and brought it back.
Mm-hmm. And that also had Martha Ray in it. That
Martha Ray, Shirley Ross, Bob Burns.
Song like Blue Hawaii. And so I think we'll open with a lighter touch song from Blue Hawaii. Next came Double or Nothing, Bing, with Martha Ray. And again, you had Andy Devine in this one.
Yeah.
Mary Carlisle and Bill Frawley.
Mm-hmm.
Bill showed up on several of your later radio programs.
Well, he was a great pal of mine and also a member at the Lakeside Golf Club. We went to football games together, baseball games, and boxing. He's a great sports fan, so was I. We were close friends.
Also at that time, Bing, you made a picture called Sing You Sinners with young Donald O'Connor and Fred McMurray.
Yeah. And Eileen Drew, Helen Drew was the girl.
And the hit song there was Small Fry, which you did with Fred and Donald.
That's right. Johnny Mercer wrote it.
Yeah. I don't know whether he wrote it, but I know he did a version, a recorded version with you.
Sure,
I think
he wrote the words.
Yeah, he may have written the words to it. That was a good one. And all this time you were doing your radio broadcasts and had a few interests on the side, like horse racing. Didn't you build your own
little racetrack down San Diego County, which I later sold? And I was interested in horses and racing and golf. Sports fan. Mm-hmm. Went to everything. Every kind of sport. Big baseball fan. Mm-hmm. We didn't have Major League Ball then. We had the Hollywood Stars. But it was good baseball.
Did you continue your interest, or do you continue your interest in the Bang Tails? Or
yeah, I have a few. Not racing anything. I did have an interest with a couple of horses. With a couple of Canadians, Frank McMahon and Max Bell, and we won the Irish Derby one year.
Mm-hmm.
And he won a couple other big races, particularly. Now I have a couple of mares that I bought over from Ireland. They've had three or four colts, and I've just been raising them and selling them.
Bing, that brings us to the end of today's program, but we'll be back again next week for more on the Crosby years, and I trust you will be joining us again.
Yes,
for
sure.
We are now to 1939 and 1940, Bing, and these years were the beginning of the war years and perhaps sort of the end of the light romantic musicals that you've been doing up to this time.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into heavier stuff, perhaps.
Well, it seemed that way, like Going My Way. That wasn't heavily dramatic, but it was a genuine role rather than just playing a singer in a nightclub or a guy in a band or something. Which is all I ever played before that.
You played Gus Edwards in The Star Maker.
Mm-hmm. Was that about that time?
Yeah, that was about that time. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you had a lot of good Gus Edwards tunes in it. And
some old tunes, too.
And, A Man and His Dream, which has always been one of my favorites.
Good song.
Let's open the show with a Gus Edwards medley from The Star Maker. Have you ever heard, Bing, the Calypso song about you that was sung by a man called The Lion, Indian performer? Well, we're going to run that in here now so that
cute
people...
Song.
Yeah, it is a cute song.
Takes off his hat infrequently. Is that in there?
Yeah, that's in there. And also quite a few of your contemporaries were mentioned in this song. So we'll listen to that right now. Bing, in 1940, you and Bob Hope hit the road for the first time with Dorothy L'Amour. The show was The Road to Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't it Scherzinger who directed
Victor it? Scherzinger. He was a songwriter and also a director.
And that took off like gangbusters. That really set the pattern for the
story. Yeah, it caused a little attention, a little notice.
Was that the first time you had ever worked with Hope to get, actually worked with him in tandem? Or had you done some stage things before then? Or both?
Benefits, I think. Now, of course, on the radio, we'd started that little pseudo feud that we had going, He'd been kneeling me, and I'd been kneeling him, and I guessed it on his show, and I kept it on mine. That sort of thing went on.
Dorothy L'Amour often said that you threw quite a curve at her while you were doing these road pictures because you and Bob ad-libbed a lot.
Well, we thought it would lend spirit to the piece, if we wouldn't tell one another exactly what we were going to say. You have to stick to the script in a general way to just keep the storyline intact, but I would always prepare a few snappers, and of course he'd have a sheaf snappers ready for me, and she'd be standing there in the middle,
trying to get in something,
crawl in somewhere. I think it helped the pictures, and it gave them an ad-lib flavor, and more natural, more like a couple of hallroom boys clowning around. The writers didn't like this too much. Well, they were good-natured about it, I guess, but they kind of, once in a while, they put in an objection that we were tinkering with the story too much. I don't know what how serious the story was, and it should be preserved in all its pristine perfection.
It would appear to me that perhaps the story should have been better left alone.
But you had to have a framework, you know, to hang these addicts on.
Bing, another picture in this period was If I Had My Way, and you had a covey of old-time vaudevillians in that. Eddie Leonard, Blanche Ring, Trixie Ferganza, Grace LaRue, Julian Elting.
Yeah.
And that...
those are all names that I saw on vaudeville when I was a kid, mm-hmm. a young man growing up, and when I later got involved with myself, I worked with some of them.
Mm-hmm. That brings us to the end of this show, Bing, but we'll be back again next week and see what we can do as we move closer to the involvement with the war years, actually, mm-hmm. because we did get involved in a little fracas about that
yeah,
time.
We sure did.
In 1941 and 42, Holiday Inn was the big one for you picture-wise. Of course, the score by Irving Berlin, and having the opportunity to dance with Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire.
Yeah.
Well, my dancing with him didn't help the picture. His solo dancing is what made it good. And he was a big star and a big name, and he made big pictures, and it was really a great thing for me to be associated with him.
But he said you're his favorite dancing partner.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I got about two steps. I never can put anything more than that together.
But that was the one that also brought you White Christmas.
That was a song, and the picture was rather an unimportant song as far as construction of the picture was concerned. It was, I think it was after an unfortunate love affair or something. I was kind of desolate, wallowing in a slough of despond, and they mm-hmm. tapped me at a piano and just played this little song and sang it. There was no production connected with it. Mm-hmm. Set me in the film.
And the only thing it did was become the traditional
great song.
Christmas
great
song.
Great standard
yeah.
song. But it was a wonderful thing for me.
Isn't that the great thing about show business, though, that you can do something that you it's sort of a throwaway yeah. and you think nothing of it, and then all of a sudden it takes off and is a you know, it's something that...
happens constantly, particularly with songs. You mm-hmm. never know. I've never been able to pick a hit song. I mean, have somebody play something for me I've never heard before and be able to say right off, gee, that'll be a hit. I've tried it, and conversely, I've picked a lot of songs I thought would be hits that were bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody tells you that they can pick a hit song, crazy. Although it's changed now, because you get a group like the Beatles were, the Carpenters... there's a sale for anything they make, so that really doesn't apply anymore these days.
Yeah, but the Carpenters, you mentioned a Bacharach tune, for instance,
yeah.
but there's no guarantee either that all the Bacharach yeah. tunes are going to take off like Close to You did, for example.
Yeah.
There are a few along the way. Irving Berlin, of course, was one of the most prolific and talented of all the composers, and I think it might be nice to talk about some of the other composers that you worked with, some of your considerations of some of the men who wrote for you.
Well, I was a great fan of Rodgers and Hart
mm-hmm.
because of the songs and the musicals that they wrote for on Broadway. And when they were assigned to do the score for Mississippi, I was really elated because I had such great respect for them. They wrote such classy things, you know, things of quality. He was a great lyricist, Larry Hart, and of course we all know Dick Rodgers, not only with Dick, with Larry Hart, but with Oscar Hammerstein and other people he wrote with. And when they agreed to do the score with Mississippi, as I said, I was really elated. I also liked some of the songs that Vincent Humans wrote. I don't think I ever had anything in a picture that he wrote. But the things he wrote for Nona Nanette, and of course Gershwin. I never had Gershwin do a score. I had Cole Porter, a couple of scores that he wrote. All those names, to me, were magic.
Mm-hmm.
Because a singer's only as good as the song. And when you have an opportunity to sing a score that's written by people like that, you're very lucky.
Well, you also had some that were perhaps not as well known, but were awfully good craftsmen and turned out.
Well, Burke and Van Heulen were marvelous. Yeah. Burke and Johnson, Burke and Jimmy Monaco.
Mm-hmm.
Burke was a real poet. They called him the poet among the songwriting fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote some very nice words. And the three guys that he worked with, the melodist, Johnson, Monaco, and Van Heusen, of course, the great melody writers, they've all proven it. That was a very lucky association for me to be associated with a guy like Burke. He wrote some wonderful things for the road pictures, cute mm-hmm. things, beautiful ballads like Moonlight Becomes You and The Sweet Potato Piper and The Road to Morocco itself, and all those gag songs. He was a great, great writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do have to depend on a good writer
you get a score written by guys like that.
I should
that.
Say so. Have you a favorite score that you consider the overall best that you've ever experienced in a picture?
No, that'd be hard for me to say. There have been so many great scores. Burke and Van Heusen scores, the Mississippi score, you know, with Soon and the Easy to Remember and the Down by the River. Although those were not big hits, that was a marvelous score.
Mm-hmm.
I like very much the score that Cole Porter did for High Society.
Yeah, that was a great score.
Good score. Some nice songs in there.
We're going to get to those in a program.
Pretty much anything Burke and Van Heusen wrote for the road pictures. I think every road picture had a good musical score.
Bing, did you feel that the road pictures opened up a sort of a new career in comedy for you because of the
yes.
play with
Oh,
Hope?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. He taught me a lot. Working with him, I learned a lot about timing. And I've done a lot of jokes in vaudeville and sketches with vaudevillians and before that, but I think working with Hope really polished it off.
Well, you came out of the era of sort of playing the callow youth lover
yeah.
of the early musicals.
Singing Under the Window,
yeah.
and serenading.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
And the obdurate mother who wouldn't allow her daughter to go out with the guy in the band, you know.
Yeah, that's the Sennett comedy era, isn't it?
Yeah.
Max Sennett shorts that you did.
Mm-hmm.
America was at war in 1942, Bing. And you were among the first contingent to hit the road for war bonds. I remember seeing you with an all-star show in Minneapolis, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, that was the Hollywood Cavalcade.
Mm-hmm.
That special train. That
yeah.
was some train.
Oh, my.
Just mention some of the stars, if I can remember them. There was Cagney, Pat O'Brien, Frank McHugh, Charles Boyer, Desi Arnaz, Spencer Tracy, Oliver, Laurel and Hardy, Claudette Colbert, Merle Oberon, Irene Dunne, the Marx Brothers.
Seems to me Cary Grant was
Cary Grant. That's just some of them. And that was a train full of people like that. You can imagine the hysteria that developed en route.
Oh, gosh.
Every little town.
That would have to have been the greatest all-star show that ever
hit
the road.
It was a great show, too. It was well put together. We had Al Newman, the musical director, who was head of music at 20th Century Fox. Great orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
It was really an event. That was a war bond thing. Went all across the country, finished up in Washington, D.C. That's where Groucho Marx made one of his famous cracks. Eleanor Roosevelt was taking a group to see the White House. And it was a long gallery of ex-presidents. And she was explaining who they all were. And we were all listening quietly and behaving properly.
Mm-hmm.
And we came to a picture of General Grant, and he asked her, he said, Mrs. Roosevelt, did General Grant wear a Van Dyke, or did Van Dyke wear a General Grant? That broke it up.
Bing, we've come to the conclusion of this program. Next year we'll be continuing with some of your involvement during the war years and entertaining the troops and so forth. And
they were great days. It was a great privilege to be asked to go over and do this kind of work. Had a lot of fun and a lot of work and a lot of nervous moments.
We'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
Bing,
how far are you going to go?
Bing, it's still the war years for us. And as 1943 came along, you made a picture called Dixie, which was another biographical film along the lines of The Star Maker, only it was about
Daniel Emmett.
Daniel Emmett.
Who wrote Dixie.
Mm-hmm. And he died the same year that you came into the world.
Is that
you know
right?
That?
Yeah. No, I didn't know that.
He died
that.
At the age of 89.
Well, he had a ripe old life, productive life.
And he never knew that there was a little baby being born that year who would one day be...
Make a picture about his life.
Yeah.
That was with L'Amour, I think. Billy DeWolf?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. They were in it. Uh-huh. That was a nice picture.
That was Van Heusen and Burt. They had a song in there, Sunday, Monday, and Always.
Right.
Yeah.
And this was your first picture in Technicolor.
Was it?
Yeah, Dixie.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's start with Sunday, Monday, and Always. 1943, Bing, you went on a war bond tour with Phil Silvers, and that must have been a ball.
Phil Silvers, Rags Raglan.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Van Heusen to accompany us.
Mm-hmm.
And on the piano. Raglan was a great comic, came out of the burlesque days. Marvelous, low comedian, hokey comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And he and Silvers had a lot of things they did together. And they both did a single. And we played all the camps around the West. They used to get in an argument every once in a while, Raglan and Silvers, about the act, you know, who's the best, who's the most important. And one of the bits they did in the act, Silvers did a hokey magician,
mm-hmm.
and he asked for volunteers out of the audience, and Raglan would get up as a volunteer. And all through the next routine, Phil would pull colored silk handkerchiefs of different hues out of various places from Rags's clothing and anatomy, out of his ear and out of the back of his neck and out of his sleeve as they went along. He'd just keep producing these handkerchiefs. So they had this argument, and we were doing a show at Camp Carson, I think it was, up in Colorado. And Phil did his single, and then he called for the volunteer from the audience, and Rags got up and stood there with Phil and said, "You're a pretty funny man, aren't you?" And Phil said, "Yeah." So he says, "We'll see what you can do with these." And he handed him a whole bunch of handkerchiefs and walked out.
Well, that calls to mind the fact that Phil Silvers once gave me a singing lesson.
Oh, yes,
yeah.
he does a
yeah.
bit. In fact, we used that bit
did
in
you?
The act. Yeah, he gave me a singing lesson.
Yeah, where he hits you on the cheek and says the round, pear-shaped tone.
Yeah.
That's very funny, but he did it quite unexpectedly. I was doing a TV show back in Minneapolis, and Phil was a guest on it, and he sat down,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he was saying, "You ever sing on your show?" And I innocently walked right into it. I said, "Oh, well, I've done, you know, a little number."
Must have been hilarious, done with you, because,
nobody
expects a gag. They figure it's going to be a straight...
That's right, and he led me into it.
And the hell out of you, too.
And he said, "Well, sing."
He used to do it with Rooney. It was very funny.
Mickey
bit.
Rooney?
Always a funny bit with Rooney. And he did it with me on this tour, and... at the benefits of one. He does it with anybody that has a reputation as a singer.
He's a very funny man. Bing, you...
I saw him the other day at the racetrack. He's had a stroke.
Oh, no.
It was very sad. He was in a hit show on Broadway. He needed a hit show.
It was a musical redo.
Of The Way to the Florida.
Yeah.
Tremendous hit. And he had this stroke, and I was in Africa at the time, and I sent him a letter of encouragement. He was in the hospital. But he's up and around now, and he appreciated the letter. He told me that it buoyed up his spirits a little, and on with the racetrack, and he's in good shape and ready to work again.
Gee, I'm glad to hear that.
Good news for all of us, because he's a gifted comedian.
Oh, very, very. One of the funniest men. Bing, you also got overseas. I think you sailed on the Ile de France to entertain servicemen, and about that time you were dubbed Uncle Sam with Whiskers.
That was quite an experience on that boat. I think there was 18,000 men on the Ile de France. They slept in shifts, you know. You could have a bed for 8 hours, then you had to get up. I'll never forget, I was in a ward room with a bunch of other beds, bunks, and right next door was paratroopers, detachment of paratroopers, this one tough guy. Every time, we were doing shows all day on the boat, down in the different decks, the mess room, the dining room, 6 or 8 shows a day we'd do to entertain these 18,000 men. And this one guy, he'd greet me every time I'd come out of the room, out of the door, he'd say, "Sing something." I said, "I got to get downstairs." And I was always busy, you know. So he got pretty mean about it. "I don't think you can sing at all." The next time he stopped me, he said, "You sing lousy the next time. And who wants to hear you sing?" But he'd always be there.
Yeah.
So about the last day out, I came on and he said, "Sing something." So I sang some song. He listened for a while. "He's like I thought," he said, "lousy." He was from Boston, a real tough Boston Irishman.
Well, you contributed a great deal to the war effort, Bing, particularly through command performances and V-discs and that sort of thing, aside from your personal appearance.
Yeah, it was the Armed Forces Radio and Television. Mm-hmm. It wasn't television then, but we were over there all the time. They had 3 or 4 programs, command performance, mail call. Can't think of the other, but I was kind of a regular on most of them.
Mm-hmm.
Meredith Wilson was musical director of the whole thing. He was a major then. And a lot of Hollywood writers worked on the staff. It was just like a big studio, really. Mm-hmm. And they were all in the service, all these writers, musicians, by the band. But it was not much discipline in that post.
No.
It was really a scream around there. Some of the
You must have had a fantastic reaction to the reaction of the servicemen, particularly the ones overseas when you appeared.
Yeah, it was kind of sad sometimes, you know.
Yeah, right.
They always want to hear White Christmas, and when I'd sing it, they'd all cry. Some of them would. And I always finished with that, and I have to leave on a sad note. And we did shows out in the field and up at the field hospitals, and sometimes the men badly hurt, you know, and you'd have to cheer them up. I remember one time we did a show in a burned-out hangar near Metz. Well, it wasn't burned out. It had some roof on it, and they put up a stage, and we must have had 5,000 or 6,000 men in there as we were following General Bradley's army then.
Mm-hmm.
And we just got the show started, and some guy handed me a slip, you know, make this announcement. So I announced all men of Company B, so-and-so, report such a place. And I'd do a little more show and another slip, all men of Company C, report. Finally, I wound up at the end of the night. We only had a couple hundred men left, you know, in the audience. Finished the show, and the next day, like the next 2 days, we hit the field hospitals, and I run into these guys on stretchers, in bed, or on the grass, all shot up. And a lot of them would ask me, what happened after I left the show? What'd you do after that? You know, you were just talking to the girl, and you told her this, and what'd you say next? And did you sing anything more after that? And so I'd have to do what they missed, in some cases, when I could.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of tough, you know.
I think that's tough duty, to go to entertain people when you know, especially those who...
Yeah, and the shell shock. We did a couple of shows for some shell shock guys, you know, and they just don't know what you're doing. But you got to do it.
Yeah.
And look cheerful and appear to like it. Some of them got through them a little, you know.
Bing, 1944 was a big year for you, honor-wise, because that was going my way there.
Academy Award.
Huh? Yes, Leo McCarey directed, and he must have been a sensational director. Along with
Marvelous man. He started in the Senate comedies, in the Christie comedies, before the Senate, I guess. He had a great technique as a director, and he was a good cutter. He cut as he went along. He shot only what he needed. He really used a paucity of film, very little film, not a lot of angles, because he knew what he was going to use when he shot it. He didn't shoot anything he wasn't going to use.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easy working for him for that reason. For instance, he'd play a scene in a long shot. You remember the checker game?
Yeah.
Saw the picture.
Yeah.
That was all done in one take, in one scene. Never moved the camera, never did anything. Just we sat there and played checkers and played the scene. And I said, aren't you going to take some close-ups? He said, no, it looked good to me. Why fool around?
In fact, you were such a great combination, you and Barry Fitzgerald in that picture, that you made several others after that.
I think just one, Welcome Strangers. Maybe.
Oh, I thought there was one other that he appeared in, but
I think two. Welcome Stranger, I played a doctor.
Well, the of course, Going My Way had a very nice score too.
Great
such
score.
Things as Swinging on a Star,
yeah.
and of course Tooralura, which he sang to Barry.
Yeah.
And he must have been a lot of fun to work with.
Great little man, great talent, great sense of humor.
I
couldn't understand him at the time with that brogue. One time we had a scene, he was supposed to deliver a sermon, and we rehearsed it that afternoon, and McCarey couldn't understand a word he was saying. He had such a thick, juicy brogue, you know. So he said, I want to put this on a record, on an acetate. You read it, give your sermon, and I'll record it. And you take the record home and play it, and see if you can correct these places where it's not understandable. I did that. I'll do that. Sure. Give me the record. And along you went. Next day, come back, and Leo says, well, now you got it all straightened out. How'd the record go? He says, I couldn't understand a bloody word of it.
Oh, boy. How did you feel, Bing, when Gary Cooper called out your name to present you with the Best Actor Award for that performance?
Oh, I was amazed, really. I didn't expect to get an award. I can't remember who the other fellows are. They were nominated, but I certainly didn't expect. We just went to the Academy Awards every year as a matter of habit, you know. But I knew when he started, he had the envelope, and that sly grin came over his face, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He was reading it, but we couldn't see what he was reading. Then I knew that it must be me, because we were great friends.
Yeah, I think that made him very happy, the presentation of that award.
He told me that. He's a great man, a great fellow of mine.
That wasn't the first one you were nominated for, or it was the first one you were nominated for.
Yeah, I was
and you won
for
Country Girl.
Country Girl, yeah.
Yeah, which was another great show we'll be getting to in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sort of wraps us up for the 1945 and 46 years, Bing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you'll join us again next week, we'll see what happened as we pulled our way out of the war.
Gladly.
1945 and 1946 are the years this week, Bing Crosby, and it's nice to have you aboard again as usual. And that was the year Irving Berlin delivered you another great score, and Fred Astaire was again on hand for Blue Skies.
Blue Skies, that was a nice picture, pretty picture, visually and musically.
Yeah,
and a lot of good songs and a lot of good things.
Most of the songs that Berlin wrote for that had been written before.
Yes, they were standards
of his.
Things like Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the, well, of course, the title song, Easter Parade.
And again, that you've got the opportunity to dance a bit with Mr. Astaire.
Yeah, we had a song in there. Was that in there, the one about... A
couple of song and dance,
yeah, a couple of songs. Mm-hmm. I sing, I dance, yeah. That was a good piece of material.
Yeah.
That's what you call material, when you get a thing like that written for you. With comedy and bits of business to do, that's for real contribution. When a guy read something like that.
I enjoyed that number, and the one in Holiday Inn, where it was I'll Capture Her Heart, singing, dancing.
Her heart
and,
singing.
Yeah, you had a chance to work in tandem there.
Challenge kind of a thing.
Bing, in 1946, you revolutionized the radio industry by deciding to tape your radio programs,
mm-hmm.
and you got some resistance on that.
Strong
sponsors
resistance.
Didn't want to play around with it.
Networks too.
Yeah.
Why... We were associated at that time with a fellow named Jack Mullen, who had got back from Germany. He was in the signal corps. He was an officer, captain, I think. And while over there, he had found a device for tape, a piece of machinery, which he brought back. And he showed it to my brother, and my brother got interested in developing it. And he took it to Ampex. They were keen about it. So it looked like a way... To me, to, you know, we used to have to do two broadcasts, one for the East and one for the West. To eliminate that, if you get a show on tape, plus the fact you could tape anytime you wanted to,
mm-hmm.
plus the fact you could edit the tape, you could do a show, if anything was bad, you could do the part over that was bad and interpolate it. It seemed like such a convenient way to do a show that I really was zealous in getting it sold to the network, but to... They resisted, the trade papers resisted it. I remember the Hollywood Reporter and the Daily Variety. All thought it would destroy all the spontaneity of the show, all the life and everything that a live show has, the audience contact, the audience reaction would be lost. But we did it in front of an audience, and it made a bit of difference.
Yeah.
And, of course, I kept fighting for it. I think I finally just kind of put my foot down and said I was going to play golf for a while or something. And... So they agreed to try it. It worked great. And as you know, it took over, and now I guess pretty everything's taped.
Yeah, there's nothing much that's live either on radio or television. I think the only thing that's live these days is news, and
mm-hmm.
that by virtue of what it
and
is.
And a good sports event.
And a good sports, which are in a sense news.
And the same problem developed on television when they developed the videotape. They said, well, you can't do that with a television show. It'll, again, lose spontaneity and life and audience contact and everything. Now they're all taping comedy shows. We tape a show now without even an audience.
I know.
A lot of shows do, and then they put in the laughs. But the kind of shows I've been doing don't have a lot of comedy in it. We don't try to put in any laughs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a laugh track, unless it's well done, can sometimes throw the audience.
Very diverting. Very disturbing.
Very bad. That wraps us up for 1947 and 48, Bing. And next week we'll be getting to 47 or 48 and 49 or whatever's next up here.
Uh-huh.
And I hope you'll be with us.
Yes, sir.
Bing, let's talk a little bit about some of the other high points in your career, or rather, the things that interest you. The Crosby Classic, for example, must be one of the big things you look forward to each year, the golf.
Yeah, but it's not the Crosby Classic, it's the Hope Classic. I don't want to be confused with him.
Oh, why?
It's the Crosby Pro-Am.
The Crosby Pro-Am.
Yeah.
Well, but it has become, in its way, a classic.
Standard,
well, it's been on longer
than... perennial, yeah. It's the first of its kind.
Yeah, the first of its kind.
I think we're in our 33rd year now.
Mm-hmm.
We missed the war years, and after that it's been going steadily.
I thought the last one that was held was a real cliffhanger when you had a three-way playoff.
Well, that's what makes for good television when you're talking about golf tournament. If some fella comes to the last day and the last nine holes with a lead that can't possibly be cut down, if he's five or six strokes up on the field, well, you haven't got much of a television show. Mm-hmm. There's no suspense, there's no drama. We've been lucky. We've had several playoffs, several close finishes, and of course last year was a significant example of the kind of finish you want.
Who do you consider the greatest golfer you've ever seen?
Jack Nicklaus.
Without question.
I played with every golfer from Bobby Jones on. Jones, Hagen, Saracen, then on up through the Hogan, Nelson years and the Palmer years. Jack has tremendous length off the tee, as everybody knows. He's got a velvet touch with a putter, a chip shot, trap shot. For a big, husky fella, he's got a remarkably soft, delicate touch. He is a deep thinker on the golf course. He figures out everything he's going to do, how he's going to play a hole. And he's got a concentration that is unflappable. There's no way you can disturb him when he steps up to a shot and gets ready to hit it. I recall watching him on television several years ago, playing some tournament in the East, and it was raining, blowing a gale. He was wearing one of those soft canvas hats.
Yeah.
Never saw him with a hat before, but this was because of the rain. He came to the last hole, and he had about a four-foot putt for a win on the tournament. The wind was whipping. He stood up over the putt, and as you know, he stands there quite a long while. And about midway during his reverie, a gust of wind just whipped that hat off his head and flew off. He never moved. Just stayed right there, hit the ball, knocked it in, and then started looking for his hat.
That's cool.
Now, the average professional, when that happened, would have backed away, gone through the whole ritual again, sizing up the break of the green, the distance, pick up infinitesimal bits of grass and sand, and then stepped up to the ball. But Jack never even knew the hat blew off.
Yeah. Well, I've seen this.
That's concentration.
I know, and I've seen this happen in tournaments, especially when they get up to where there is a danger of a playoff, where one of the guys would get up there and he'd get all set, and then for some reason or other he walks away, and
can't
I say he's
trigger.
Had it.
He can't pull the trigger.
And he doesn't come through.
I think Jack is the greatest that ever lived, yeah. And he's got a lot of big tournament wins ahead of him, too.
Bing, you have also an interest in conservation, wildlife conservation, animal conservation. What are you involved with in this kind of thing?
The big
today?
Thing is Ducks Unlimited. Been with them for years. I've done some films for them, and do a lot of promotion work for them. They're the most outstanding organization of its kind that has ever been created. They saw the critical situation that was happening in connection with the waterfowl. As you know, they migrate from Canada, go down to the United States, and finish up in Mexico. And what was happening was the loss of habitat in Canada, where they could breed, hatch, because of the encroachment of civilization, the cutting up farms, pipelines going through, highways. So they started what they call Ducks Unlimited. You pay $3 a year to be a member, and they held banquets all over the country with sportsmen attended, a little entertainment, and they solicited contributions, and they built up a good fund, and then they went up into Canada. They contacted farmers, county supervisors, provinces, either for gifts of land, or they leased the land, or they'd borrow it, but any way they could get it. They bought up heavy equipment, and they created all the way across the Canadian border in B.C., Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba. They created ponds, marshes, places for ducks to live and breed. They spent millions of dollars, a lot of work, had a big organization, and it's really brought the waterfowl population right back almost where it was before. And it'll stay that way, because they've got large resources. They know how to do it now. And it's been a real important thing if there's going to be any more waterfowl around. Then I belong to Trout Unlimited, and the big job there is the streams, the pollution of streams. We've done a lot of work and made some films. We've worked hard on a couple of bills here in the California legislature, which had met with very favorable response from Governor Reagan. He's on our team, I'm sure. He's helped us a lot with a couple of very important pieces of legislation. We've been able to clean up some streams and stop some dams from being built. We've got after the logging companies for fouling up streams with fallen trees and limbs and branches that they cut off and just lay there till the stream all clogs up. That's one other thing. And I did a big job with the Committee for the Atlantic Salmon Emergency. They found that the Danish fishing fleet had found where the Atlantic salmon were going to feed after they leave the stream. It's out in a place called the Davis Strait, not far from Greenland. And they were slowly eliminating the salmon just by netting them, thousands of tons, metric tons of salmon a year. And we appealed to the Danes, who don't have a river, for salmon to go to spawn, so they couldn't care less. We appealed to them in every possible way, and I went to Copenhagen and saw some government people there through our ambassador, and talked to a lot of sportsmen, and they formed a big committee with Ted Williams, Kurt Gowdy, myself, and a lot of guys on it, and we started working on this thing, trying to get them to stop this high seas netting. Actually, it's a reasonable thing that they should want to, because if they keep doing it, there'll be no salmon for them either.
Right.
As long as there's some control placed on the amount of salmon that they're going to be allowed to take, why, the salmon will continue to live. But it's conceivable in 1 year they could net out the whole population of any given stream in Europe, Canada, or in the United States, in Maine, up in New England. So we threatened a boycott.
Mm-hmm.
All Danish products, cheese, silver, furniture, beer, you know the things they sell over here. And they threatened to boycott all my pictures in Denmark, which wouldn't have much effect, because I haven't had a picture play there.
And you haven't had a dirty picture either.
No, I don't have any of the kind of pictures that are so popular in some of the Scandinavian areas. Anyhow, they finally got our government invested in the Nixon administration, and the best way to go at this thing, we found, is in the diplomatic level, which they did. They're phasing it out now, taking a certain amount less each year, so by 1954 it will have stopped completely. And I think, for the time being, we've saved the Atlantic salmon from extermination.
Gee, that's
wonderful. He's a great fish, a game fish, great sport fish, and a great fish on the table.
Been getting back to golfing for a moment. Don't you have a tournament over in Scotland?
I put up a tournament. I play over at St. Andrews every year. I'm a member there, the Royal and Ancient. And one of the old members there asked me if I would put on a tournament for seniors. I said, yeah, I'd be glad to. 60 and over. So he said, well, we'll have someone design a cup, very nice cup, and we'll send you the bill. I said, fine. Well, they must have gone to the most expensive engraver in all of England, and they did do a beautiful cup. It's a beautiful cup, and they give it's a perennial cup, and they give each winner a year a replica. The bill was $1,200.
That's quite a cup.
So I was a little shocked, but I went over there, and they put on the tournament. It was a big success. We had to turn away 75 or 100 people, and it's going to go on again next year. It's always held in September. I think it'll be quite a popular fixture at the R&A.
Okay. Bing, I think at this point what I'd like to do is just a couple of intros and outros, and then have you do some promo spots.
Mm-hmm.
This will be in the event we don't get back together again before the next show up. We've gone through a lot.
Yeah, I'll be around until late spring.
Late spring?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll see. We can set up another date, but I'll just use it. Well, Bing, we're back again to continue with our foray on the Crosby years, and it's been a very delightful experience thus far, and so... we're going to start out with a little song today, but I wanted to welcome you back as we get underway.
Great to be back, John. This is quite an experience for me to go back through the years and dig up all this old stuff.
Well, here's some old stuff you can listen to right now.
Let it go.
Bing, thanks very much for being with us again today, and we'll see you next week on the Crosby.
Great, I enjoyed it today, John.
Now,
I have some spots that I rotten out, and they're on the floor.
Better get your spectacles on.
Yeah,
I'll be sure I can read it without mine.
Hello, this is Bing Crosby. Beginning Sunday, June 3rd on KXL, I hope you'll be listening when John Salisbury and I begin our 26-week series on the Crosby years. It's going to be an exciting experience for me. I hope that you'll enjoy it, too. That's Sunday, June 3rd on KXL. Hello, this is Bing Crosby. Next Sunday, the new 26-week program called The Crosby Years. That's a musical portrait and sound of the great moments from show business since I first began recording. It's going to make its bow on KXL. The time is 3 o'clock. I hope you'll join us. Hello, this is Bing Crosby. This afternoon at 3 on KXL, we begin a 26-week musical portrait and sound of The Crosby Years. I'll be joining John Salisbury to talk about the highlights of those years, and I hope you'll join us. Hello, this is Bing Crosby. Next Sunday, another episode from the Crosby Years with some conversation and music from me and some of the great moments from those years compiled by John Salisbury. What are some of the highlights, John? Hello, this is Bing Crosby.
This afternoon at 3, John Salisbury and I get together for another musical portrait and sound of the Crosby years. What do you have on the agenda, John? This is Bing Crosby. I hope that you'll join John Salisbury and me Sundays at 3 for a musical montage of highlights from the Crosby years. I'll be around for some conversation and music, but my friends will be along, too. Many of the great performers I've known and worked with down through the years. Join us, won't you? That's Sundays at 3 on KXL.
Good.
Bing Crosby, we've just completed our 13-week series covering the Roosevelt years, an historic and tumultuous period in our history. And next week, we begin a new series for 26 weeks called the Crosby years, and that's where you come in.
John, I'm certainly looking forward to it, but gee whiz, 26 weeks. You think there's enough material available to fill all those hours?
Well, yes, because we're actually observing your golden anniversary in show business.
That's true.
And 50 years covers a lot of time. A lot of recordings, shows for movies, radio, television, and the people with whom you worked. You're content. I'm doing great this morning.
Oh.
You're in better voice than I am. Let's start at the top again. I'll just take it from there.
Yeah.
Yes, because we're actually observing your golden anniversary in show business. And 50 years covers a lot of time, a lot of recordings, shows for movies, radio and television, and the people with whom you worked and your contemporaries from 1923 to 1973.
23 to 73. That's an interminable cavalcade, John. I'm glad you're the one that's doing all the work on it.
Well, with your generous cooperation, Bing, just having you alone to kind of keep the record straight is beautiful, and I think you'll be hearing a few things even you've forgotten about.
Well, you know, that's what's going to make the series fascinating for me, John, a portrait in sound, if you will, of those so many rich and rewarding experiences. It starts next Sunday, huh?
Next Sunday at 3, Bing. Mm-hmm. See you then.
I'll be aboard, and hope all of you out there in KXL Radio Land are going to be aboard, too. So long for now.
I got some other promo things to get out of the way before. On the last...
Are you running?
Mm-hmm.
This is Bing Crosby, beginning Sunday, June 3rd on KXL. I do hope you'll be listening when John Salisbury and I are going to begin our 26-week series, The Crosby Years. It's going to be an exciting experience for me, and I hope you'll enjoy it, too. This is Bing Crosby. Next Sunday, the new 26-week series of programs called The Crosby Years makes its bow on KXL. This is sort of a portrait and sound of the great moments from show business during the years that I've been around. The time is 3 o'clock, and I hope you'll join us. Bing Crosby here this afternoon at 3 on KXL. We begin a 26-week portrait and sound of the Crosby years. I'm going to be joining your host, John Salisbury, to talk about the highlights of those years. I do hope you'll join us. This is Bing Crosby. Next Sunday, another episode from our Portrait and Sound of the Crosby Years with some conversation and music from me and some of the great moments from those years compiled by your host, John Salisbury. What are some of the highlights, John? This is Bing Crosby. This afternoon at 3 on KXL, John Salisbury and I are going to get together for another musical portrait and sound of the Crosby Years. What do you got on the agenda there, John?
Okay. Well, since it's 26 weeks, this is... One, and then I will add these tags to it just to give it some variety to the Sunday teasers and things.
This is Bing Crosby. Won't you join us for a portrait and sound on the Crosby years with a little help from my friends and your host, John Salisbury? What's in the picture for today, John? What's on the agenda for today, John? Who'll be coming aboard, John? And what's on the program for today, John? Who's in the portrait this afternoon, John? John, what do you have on tap today? Who are some of the friends this afternoon, John? What do you got for openers today, John? What are some of the highlights for today, John? John, what's the lineup for today? And from which friends are we getting a little help today, John? Now, this is Bing Crosby. I do hope you'll join John Salisbury and me Sundays at 3 for a musical montage of highlights from the Crosby years. I'll be around for conversation and music, but my friends will be along, too. Many of the great performers that I've known and worked with down through the years. Won't you join us? That's Sunday at 3 on KXL.
And now some closers, and then we'll get to the questions.
I'll see you next week. Until then, au revoir. Right, John, I'm looking forward to it. I'll be here. See you then. That sounds like a fascinating lineup, John. I'll see you next week. I'll be aboard, and I hope you all will join us again next week. See you all next week. Until then, bonsoir. Sounds interesting, John. Till next week, then. Oh, of course, I wouldn't miss it for the world. I didn't know some of those recordings were still bouncing around. See you next week. Till next Sunday, John, I hope all of you will join us, too. Have no fear, I'll be there. Till then, au revoir. John, I've got my calendar permanently marked for Sundays at 3 on the Crosby Years. How about that lawnmower?
I don't think it's fine.
You can count on it, John, I'll be there. You can count on it, John, I'll be here. There was a song a few years back which began with, we'll meet again, who knows where, who knows when, but the date is set for next Sunday at 3. I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places, and that's on KXL next Sunday at 3. See you then. I'll be here, John, and I hope all of you out there will be back for another episode of These Crosby Years. Well, these portraits and music bring back a lot of memories, John. You can be sure I'll be here. Oh, I sure will, John. You all come, too, you hear? You mean next week's the final show? Wow. 26 weeks. Well, I'll be on hand, but I'm truly sorry these visits are coming to an end. Thank you, John, and so long for now. Thank you, John. See you next week.
Now, when we began on the last visit, we started out with your first thing, and as I listened to it, I thought, well, we kind of got all mixed up in where we were going, so I'm going to redo that a little bit just to start the series off.
All right.
Bing Crosby, today we're beginning our 26-week series called The Crosby Years, and I can't tell you how delighted I am that you'll be with us to help make it a memorable experience.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, John. Sounds like it's going to be very exciting. I hope the listeners will find it appealing.
Well, is your memory in good shape?
You know, the passage of years is sometimes atrophies the aged mind. My powers of recall might be a little reluctant to answer when I summon them?
Well, I'll try to give you some leading questions that will take care of that.
I hope you better.
You know, Bing, there are all kinds of experts who claim any one of a number of songs is the first you ever performed. I think you yourself once said it was a song called I've Got the Girl, a duet with your partner Al Rinker,
right
about 1926.
That was with Don Clark and his orchestra, who were then playing at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles, and we made it in a warehouse somewhere down around the financial district of the industrial area.
Oh, it's sort of a warehouse.
I remember a lot of packing houses or packing boxes around, different implements of the trade.
Well, since this is our first I want to get around to that recording later on, but since this is our first program, I think we ought to begin with what probably is the first solo you recorded.
You have a copy of this thing?
Yes, I do.
Oh, handle it with care. It's got to be very fragile.
It is. It's fragile.
It's got a lot of mileage on it, that record.
How long since you've heard it?
About 35, 40 years.
Well, you're going to hear it again.
It was old then.
Yeah. All right. But we're gonna play one that is a little bit, well, it's not much more up-to-date, but at least there's an up-to-date arrangement of it with Buddy Cole at the piano in his group. And you originally recorded it with Paul Whiteman about 1927,
uh-huh.
I would think, called Muddy Water.
Muddy Water, yeah. That was a very dramatic recitation in the middle of that record. I remember. I thought it was big stuff.
Well, in Mississippi Mud, you had a sort of a little solo portion in
there.
Yeah,
that was to a melody.
Yeah.
This is a recitation.
A recitation.
I can see the water falling, rising up above my knees. Oh, I look at
that's in the original recording.
Very dramatic. Do you have that?
Yeah, let's play that one. We'll play the original. Oh, by the way, that was written in part by Harry Richman. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, great song. Bing, what I'm going to do is just throw a number of questions that are unrelated, sort of, and get this. In 1935, Paul Whiteman was in New York, and you were in Hollywood doing the Kraft Music Hall, and that created a split situation for you, which later led to your becoming host of the show on a more or less permanent basis.
Yeah, I think we were on for Kraft 10, 12 years, maybe more,
mm-hmm.
with various orchestras. There were two or three orchestras. Jimmy Dorsey was one. I think George Stoll was another, and John Scott Trotter, of course, did the major portion of it.
Yeah, and he did a lot of your recordings, too. Was he the man that you worked
many,
with?
Many, many recordings. He had a great arranger and a great feel for popular music and great taste and sophistication. But still, his arrangements were
sensible enough so the listening public could understand him and appreciate what he was doing.
Mm-hmm. When you started, of course, your theme song was Where the Blue of the Night Meets the Gold of the Day, and that probably because you wrote it or part of it?
Well, I had a hand in it, with Turk and Allard, Freddie Allard and Roy Turk.
Have you written any other songs?
Oh, a couple of verses, and I wrote a couple of things with Harry Barris. Nothing serious, and I wrote a lot of material, parodies and special material on television, radio, and in the films, gag songs, one thing or another, but nothing popular, nothing that became a hit.
Well, of course, when you talk about your writing verses, they don't play verses very often.
Verses were, in those days, were mandatory. Well, they started dropping them in the mid-30s, I guess, but prior to that time, any popular song had a verse that sometimes could be very long. Jerome Kern called it the burthen, which I guess he got from the burden of his lay, the last minstrel. And the verses set up the chorus. They told the story of what had preceded what the chorus is now going to say.
Well, Frank Sinatra did one thing. He recorded the verse to Stardust and not the chorus. And I think not the chorus, just the verse.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did it on an album.
I wandered down the street and far away, dreaming of the dee-dee-doo-doo-doo.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful melody.
Well, he had a very string background, very lush strings, and he just did the verse.
It could stand up on its own because the verse almost comes to a conclusion.
Yeah.
The melody.
Yeah, and then the strings came up and took him out. however, even though you used your theme song, I think ASCAP had a little problem at one point, and they wiped out all the ASCAP music, and you had to find a new theme for the Kraft Music Hall, which was Hail KMH.
Oh, yeah, Hail KMH, Hail Rain and Snow, forward we will go.
Yeah, and that was for the commercial breaks.
Wave the pomegranate and pusil off, that was our colors.
The what?
Wave the pomegranate and puce aloft. Hip, hip, hooray, and muzzle top. Hail, 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 hail. Hail, KMH. That was it.
Oh, well, that was at the...
Carol wrote the lyrics, I believe, for that epic...
Wasn't it for the College of Station Breaks or something like that that you and Ken Carpenter
We used to render it.
The Mythical School of Station Breaks?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was the theme song. You seem to have a love affair with words, Bing. Particularly, it was noticeable on your radio broadcasts, mm-hmm. where you just sort of carried along in beautiful style. You have that sort of a feeling for words.
I like to fool around and with words, and I've written magazine articles and articles for the conservation, for the salmon, the preservation of the salmon, and Trout Unlimited, and things like that. I do mostly, though, parodies and for benefits and charitable affairs and informal functions where they're hosting somebody. And every safari I go on, I always write a medley of about 6 or 7 popular or old standard songs and describe what happened on the safari, the funny incidents and I've done on 7 or 8 safaris or any hunting trip, quail or pheasant or duck or partridge or any fishing trip, I write a couple of little ditties using melodies from the past and setting my words to them and describing something that was amusing or spectacular or tragic or frightening, and send each party who was on the trip a copy of the record.
Did you kind of stumble across the dictionary in your legal studies when you were...
I was an omnivorous reader even as a child, John. I read and read and read, and I think I built up some sort of a vocabulary. I think I overdo it a little. I get fascinated by some big word and beat it to death.
I'll bet your writers had fun. With Bill Morrow and Myrtle McKenzie, were you...
Myrtle was the producer, the engineer and producer, and Bill was the writer. He was one of the writers. But before Bill, I had Carol, and he was a great writer.
Mm-hmm.
He did all the KMHs. Bill joined me after that. I think Bill was on some of the KMHs, too. I'm not sure. I've always been associated with great writers like Hal Cantor and Ed Boulogne and guys like that, really good rap.
You do a great job of ad-libbing. The people who have collected your so-called fluff records and your boo-boos have remarked upon this. Some of them are not quite arable, I'm afraid.
No. Well, these days, pretty anything seems to get by on television. Of course, the radio is a little more strict, which I applaud. I don't think any of those things have been on the radio.
Not that I've heard, no.
I'm sure I'd get a sharp note from my friends up at Gonzaga.
Yes, you might. You might have that. Then you did an album that was rather a departure for you, Ballad for Americans on one side and Man Without a Country on the other. That Ballad for Americans is quite a tremendous piece
of
music.
Big piece of material, isn't it? Very impressive. I see I missed it, but they did Man Without a Country on television just recently. I wish I'd have seen it.
It's very, very good. Well, I saw it. Very well done.
It's a great story. I hope my kids saw it. I left word for them to see it. I was on a trip.
Another movie that I particularly enjoyed, I think it was because one of your co-stars with opera star Dorothy Kirsten was Mr. Music.
Yeah.
And the song My Lady is one of my all-time Crosby favorites.
Well, now that's a rare statement. I haven't heard anybody speak of that song but you.
Well, it really is very melodic, and I think you fared very well with Mr.
That was Johnny Burke and Van Heusen, wasn't it?
Probably so.
I think so, yeah.
But do you have a feel for classical music as well as popular and opera?
Well, I'm not very knowledgeable about it, John, but I like to listen to pretty near all classical music, but some of the well-known orchestras, opera, too. I like particularly the Puccini operas, the Verdi operas. Don't care much for Wagner. Some great melodies in Wagner, but they're too heavy and too lengthy for me.
Well, Puccini probably wrote the best music, because so much of it has been used in popular music.
Well, Harry Warren, admittedly, himself, he admits that he really leans on Puccini.
Yeah, I imagine so. And so many others have, too. Freddie Martin leaned on a lot of them.
Tchaikovsky, but I like all classical music. If it's well done and with great orchestras, the things Leonard Bernstein does, his Saturday concerts for young people, Stolte is a marvelous conductor, does some wonderful things with the Chicago Symphony. We have some great music here in San Francisco. San Francisco, culturally, I think, is the equal of any city in America in its development of the symphony and the opera. We have a wonderful opera company here, and the city supports it very well, too, and a wonderful theater.
Yeah, the San Francisco Opera Company's season, this year particularly, is a great one.
They reach out and do some real exploratory things, experimental things, and sometimes some wild things.
And as a matter of fact, I come down here to see them every once in a while because I'm afraid I'm not going to get to New York to see them.
You'll see everything here that you'll see in New York, I think.
I think
probably
so,
just
too.
As well done.
White Christmas you made with Rosemary Clooney and Danny Kaye.
Mm-hmm.
And Danny being one of the...
Vera...
I almost said Vera Vague.
Yep.
Vera... no. Oh. He escapes me now.
Better cut this part.
Yeah.
He was set second lead. Little girl, thin girl.
No, it wasn't Miles.
No.
Ellen. Vera Ellen.
Vera Ellen. Oh, we've got
We did. You did White Christmas with Rosemary Clooney, Danny Kaye, Vera Ellen.
Vera Ellen, and
that was an all Berlin score.
Mike Curtiz directed it. What a great director he was, and what a lot of fun. He was a Middle European light opera singer, and Jack Warner. He made a couple of pictures after his career finished as a singer over there in Vienna or wherever he was, Budapest. And then he made a couple of movies, and Jack Warner sent for him. Here's this Middle European light opera singer and film director. Hardly spoke a word of English. The first picture Jack Warner gave him to do was Little Caesar. Story of a Chicago gangster.
Yeah.
And he made a big hit out of it. And all his pictures were hits, but he was amazing, a guy to work with. He'd applaud you. Such excitement back of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
He'd applaud the funny scenes. He'd cry back of the camera during the sad scenes. We'd go to see the rushes the next day of the previous day's work, and he'd applaud the rushes. Look at those kids up there, what they're doing. What funny monkey shines they're doing up there. Oh, they're killing me, these kids, that Danny boy.
Yeah. Well, Danny must have been a lot of fun to work with.
And Danny would like egg him on, of course, because he loved to hear the dialect. Mm-hmm. He had a beautiful dialect.
Yeah. Danny, by the way, is a partner in our station.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Well,
he's one of the co-owners.
And he's very active in all fields.
Yes, he is.
Good pilot, you know. He has his own plane.
Right.
A big pilot.
And a big baseball fan.
A nut
on baseball.
Complete.
And Chinese cooking.
He is? I didn't know that.
He's got a whole Chinese kitchen in his home. being the one of the great performances that you gave, which must have been quite a challenge for you, was in The Country Girl with now Princess Grace Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, you were nominated for an Academy Award for that.
That's right. She won the award.
Yeah, she did.
The same picture.
Was that the biggest challenge in pictures you've
had? Yes, it was. But a marvelous director and writer, George Seaton, a very understanding man, a patient man, with endless tolerance, and you put up with me. And I'd seen the play in New York, and I liked it very much. But I never thought that I'd be a possibility for the role. He conceived the idea of making it a semi-musical with a couple of songs and making this actor that I've played instead of a has-been dramatic actor, a has-been musical comedy actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went ahead and accepted it with full confidence that Seton would make it come out somehow.
How did you react when you saw the completed film?
Well, I never liked myself on the screen very much. It always seems to me that it's not very good, not very well done. Always seems to me that somebody else could have done better. But, you know, if you're an actor, you try everything. Hope that it'll be acceptable.
It was about this time, I know that you attended the Academy Awards with Catherine Grant. Wasn't that about the time you met her?
Just about that time. She was a contract player at Paramount, and that's where we made the picture.
And she's very active in theater today.
She works for the ACT, the American Conservative Theater. Their season just closed. Mm-hmm. She was in, they change plays. They have about six or eight plays they do during the season, and they alternate them. She was in Cyrano, House of Blue Leaves, Crucible, and Can't Take It With You, I think.
Bing, well, you haven't mentioned the fact that I think it was in 1952 you went to Europe to make a picture, which was a charming picture with Claude Dauphin and a little boy whose name escapes me, called Little Boy Lost.
Yeah.
And which also had a score which had you singing in both French and English.
Uh-huh.
And as I recall, you went kind of under protest because at that time your wife, Dixie, was very ill.
Very ill, and it was quite a wrench to have to go away for that period of time. But they'd made all the plans, and half the crew was over there. And they had a lot of money already sunk into the production, and there was no alternative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know it was a great loss when she passed away, but I'd like to ask, what was her influence on your career and on your life?
Well, she was very musical. She came from Nashville, Tennessee, which is now the home of practically all recorded popular music. And she liked music, and that's how I became acquainted with her. She came to Coconut Grove to hear the band, and she was a contract player there at 20th Century Fox Studio. And I always solicited her approval on anything I sang or did. She sang very well herself, but she was terribly shy about her singing, which is too bad, because I'm sure she could have done a lot of great things in music if she'd had the temerity to go ahead with it and push it and drive it.
Was she your severest critic, as they say?
Yes, she was. She was a very simple critic. She'd just say no or yes, you know, don't like it. Mm-hmm. You can do better.
Let's talk about High Society for a moment, with a score by Cole Porter that wouldn't quit, and a cast that included Satchmo, Louis Armstrong,
mm-hmm.
and Sinatra, Celeste Holm,
yeah.
and a score. I have a
great bunch of music in that picture, yeah.
I have a favorite in that, too. Samantha.
One of mine. And strangely enough, the thing never became a big hit, that song, but there was quite a coterie, a cult of Samantha lovers, you know.
Yeah, well, I think the way it was done, Louis was playing a very sweet trumpet,
mm-hmm.
and then you kind of eased into the thing after it was about halfway.
Kind of a ruminative delivery.
Yeah, right. But I thought it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. Of course, Now You Has Jazz and all that, they were all great hits. Man on Fire was about the only picture you made I can remember that you didn't sing in. Did you? You didn't have any songs in that.
I don't think so.
No, I think that was a straight dramatic role.
Mm.
And
I'm just trying to think, John. Let's see.
It was the story of a divorce or something, or a
broken home.
Broken home.
And
broken
a young boy who was torn between the two protagonists.
Mm-hmm. And I think I don't know how well that did at the box office, but
it did pretty well. It was very dramatic. There were some real tense moments in that picture.
No, I shouldn't say it was the only one that you didn't sing in. I don't remember your singing in Stagecoach.
Just a little ad-lib something, over a bottle of booze.
That was
played a drunken doctor.
One Thomas Mitchell had played in the original mm-hmm. version. Sinatra had a sort of a stock company going for a few years in the early 60s. He had Sammy Davis and
Dean Martin.
And Dean Martin and
Peter Lawford.
Bishop and Peter Lawford, and he roped you in on something called Robin and the Seven Hoods.
Yeah, that was done over at Warner's.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's where I first met you, as a matter of fact.
Were you down there on the set?
We did our first interview for one of the earlier shows on
Warner
the set.
Warner Brothers studio, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I saw it recently and got quite a kick out of it.
I haven't seen it since it was made, I don't think.
Oh, there's some good songs in it. Of course, you walked away with the show at the end. You left all the other Santa Clauses standing out on the street, if you recall. I think you made off with a girl and everything else.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
I'll have to see that.
Which in a Sinatra picture sounds
hard to do. That's seldom done.
Bing, you once received, I think, a Doctor of Music from the school from which you didn't graduate, Gonzaga.
Uh-huh.
And later on, dedicated the Crosby Library there, or you presented the Crosby Library.
Yeah, we built it for them, and a couple of rooms are a repository for some of the awards, or some of the plaques, some of the citations, some of the things that I've accumulated over the years I've given to the library, and they're displayed there for visitors who come through.
Well, we're going to send a set of these shows up to the library.
That's very nice, John. They'll appreciate that. Father Carroll's the library.
Yes,
I'm sure he'll be elated.
I talked to him about it and asked him if he'd like to have them because I thought that'd be a good repository for the complete collection.
Mm-hmm.
Your TV debut was made in about 1952. Did you approach that with some trepidation?
I can't remember, John. I'm sure it was certainly a little trepidation, if not fear. abject fright. Was it alive? It had to be live.
Yes, it was live.
What was it?
Well, you first appeared on some kind of a special program, but your own show is the one I'm talking about, which was called, I think, the Bing Crosby Show. But I think you appeared on a General Electric special or a telethon.
They were the sponsors
of that
before that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
as a guest performer along with others. But I think you, I saw the first regular Crosby show, and I was delighted with it.
I'm sure I saw it, but I can't remember who was in it or anything. Can you?
No, I can't. I'll have to look it up. I think it must be around someplace.
Probably had Hope in it.
But I think you were reluctant.
Yeah,
it probably did.
He was available. I'm sure you had. Pinned him down.
Yeah. But you were reluctant to give up radio because you and Rosemary Clooney went on for quite some time doing a radio series.
Yeah.
On a daily basis on CBS.
Didn't we have Buddy Cole?
Buddy Cole.
Yeah. We built up quite a library through the medium of that program. Some of them were issued as records, but most of them I just have the acetates or the tapes. But, but we did a lot of songs every day and accumulated quite a library.
You did them all, or most of them, I understand, in the initial recordings of them in Rosie's living room.
A lot of them. Yeah. And a lot of them down Palm Springs, where I had a house at the time. Anywhere, he had a small combo, Buddy had. I think it was about four or five guys. Nick Fatou and about four or five piece combination. Bass, guitar, drums, and piano, I think.
Didn't you do a series then of sort of situation comedies with maybe a song per show with Beverly Garland?
I did a year of that. Yeah, that, oh boy, I hated that. I love Beverly Garland. She's a marvelous girl, marvelous actress. But every day for 6 or 7 months with the same kind of material, you know, about a couple of children, their problems. It was pretty dull.
Mm-hmm.
And all day long, every day, I was sure glad to get out of that.
How'd you get into it?
I know somebody talking into it in a loose moment I exceeded.
Bing, what are some of your recollections of great performances you've seen, both as individuals, individual performers, and shows in particular, if you were to look back on the highlights?
Gee, now you've tested me, John. Way back, you're thinking of
that. No, not necessarily. Just, I just flashes of what you would consider to be brilliant performances. I know in your book, Call Me Lucky, you mentioned you'd never forget Ethel Waters singing Dinah.
First time I ever saw her was in Chicago. Yeah, I was with Whiteman, and she was working out at some cafe, Green Mill, or one of those places. And I'd had her records, of course, and was a great follower of hers. And she walked out, this tall, handsome woman with a great, big, broad smile, and just walked out full of assurance and opened her mouth, and that magic sound came out, Dinah. Is there anyone finer? And I fell right down.
Yeah. Well, that's the sort of thing I was talking about. Whether there were specific things that come to mind immediately.
Well, the first time I ever saw Al Jolson was in Spokane. He used to come through on every time he'd have a big Broadway musical show, he'd take it on tour, and I saw two or three of his shows, and the first time I saw him work was really impressive to me. The electricity that this man generated when he performed was fantastic.
Did you emulate him at all in your
youth? I did, yeah. I'm sure, whether consciously or unconsciously, I did. Some of the style, some of the delivery he had, I must have acquired.
Later on, you had an opportunity to work with him on your show and on his.
Yeah, 8 or 10 times, I think, we had him on.
Is there any show, Bing, that you regret not having done where you've seen a show and you've come forward and said, gee, I wish I'd had that part?
Yeah, there was a show, John, called Rainmaker. It was a big hit in New York as a straight play. I saw it, and after seeing it, I started the wheels in motion to try and buy it and to see if I could do it. I thought it was a good part for me, just about the kind of thing that I had been doing, but a much better property. And Paramount finally bought it, but they gave it to Burt Lancaster.
Mm-hmm.
He was a great actor, and he did a fine job. It's a good picture. I'd like to have done that with some songs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a straight play, but it was wide open for interpolation of some music.
One play that was put on television, you were in High Tor. That was a Maxwell Anderson play to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and with Julie Andrews and Everett Sloan,
mm-hmm.
they added some music,
mm-hmm.
and that was a special on television.
Yeah, Hans Conried was in it, too.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, we did it, I think Arthur Schwartz got Maxwell Anderson, who wrote the play, to write the lyrics to some songs. They're beautiful songs. It's one of the best scores I've ever heard. Never got off the ground. Someday I'm going to revive a couple of those songs because they're very fine.
Which ones did you particularly like?
Oh, you got me again.
I was trying to think of the titles, too. We'll think of them and use them. There was a thing called John Barleycorn, that was a comedy song.
Yeah.
And When You're in Love.
Da-da-da-da.
When You're in Love.
Yeah, great
and
Everett
Sloan did that, and then there was... It was a kind of a mystery thing about it. It was out of the past. It was a beautiful show, and fortunately, there's an album of it, which
the past has flown. Da 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 da. That's not much of a demonstration.
No, but it gives me an idea. You once put out an album called "Songs I Wish I'd Sung the First Time Around." There must have been quite a few that you wish you had sung, and I suppose some of them you turned down because you didn't think they'd go and regretted it later.
Well, there's so many songs submitted to anybody who was active in those days on the radio or in the record business that you couldn't do them all, and so you missed some good ones. And some I turned down, too. At the very beginning, when they'd come around, as they used to do in those days, the song pluggers would come around with the latest material that their publishing house had picked up, and they'd demonstrate them for you, and a couple of them, more than a couple, I really didn't think sounded very good. Later learned I was completely wrong when they became hits, and those are some of the songs that I tried to include in that album.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been very good at picking songs. Very few people, I think, have a accurate record of picking hits. Hard to do.
In your book, Call Me Lucky, you said that Dixieland was your favorite type of music.
Still is, yeah. It lifts the spirits. I still like Al Hurt, and I think Pete Fountain's got a marvelous group down in New Orleans. And the group's all over the country, but they're outstanding, I believe. And there's a band now that's played around the country. I've used them twice down at the golf tournament in Pebble Beach, where we have a show every year, called the Great American Jazz Band, with Bobby Haggard and Yank Lawson and Bud Freeman, Ralph Sutton. It's about 6 or 7 all-stars, and they are tremendous. If they ever come up your way, be sure and listen to them. If you like that kind of music.
I do like it.
They're the best I've ever heard. These guys have been together now 3 or 4 years. They tour all over the United States and Europe. They play an engagement here in San Francisco every year and one in Los Angeles. And they're coordinated, and they got everything set. There's still an opportunity for various soloists to expand and improvise if they wish, but it's a wonderful performance, and I think anybody who likes that kind of music would be thrilled to hear them.
But did you say that you bring them down to the Pro-Am at Pebble Beach?
Yeah, we have a show there every year.
Before
the tournament starts, we have a dinner
and
a show, and they've been in it the last 2 or 3 years. They've been really the headliners.
Speaking of Pebble Beach and golf, have you ever hit a home run? Have you ever sunk a hole in one?
9 holes in one.
Nine?
Yeah. I have a hole in one The one I'm the most proud of is on the par 3/16th at Cypress Point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a par 3, as I said. It's about 220-yard carry over the torrent, the raging waves of the Pacific Ocean. And there's only been three, and the course is about 50 years old, I guess. Not that it's that hard a hole, but there's so many elements involved, the wind and the carry over the sea. You think there'd be more, but there hasn't been, and that's the hole in one that I am the happiest about.
Is that the toughest course you've ever played?
No, Pebble Beach is one of the toughest. That's right next to it. But that particular hole is certainly the hardest par 3, I think, in the world.
I'd dearly love to get down to one of those Pebble Beach tournaments and just watch it take place. I've watched it on the tube. But,
quite a function.
Yeah.
Lots of laughs, lots of serious golf. The greatest players in the world are there, along with some of the worst.
I hope you have the parties after the tournament rather than before.
Well, we used to have it after, but we found that some of the players, you know, didn't qualify for the last day's play, amateurs and professionals, and they'd take right off.
Mm-hmm.
And so Sunday night, we'd only have about half the people there that we wanted to have there. There were men who had engagements elsewhere. The amateurs had to be work Monday, so they'd just take off. And so we'd have it now the night before the tournament, when everybody's in good spirits, nobody's deflated because they've played badly, and everybody is more or less happy to be there and ready for some fun.
One of your other recreational pursuits is fishing. I know you're an avid fisherman.
Yeah, there's a new bunch of rods I just got over there.
You've been fishing all your life.
Since I was a child,
What's the challenge of the... do you deep sea fish mostly?
About half and half. Or maybe I think freshwater fishing more than deep sea. I've done deep sea fishing in Hawaii and, of course, off the California coast, but I've been down now at Baja, California for 10 or 12 years. I have a little house down there, and that's for the marlin and the dorado and the yellowtail and the tuna and that kind of fishing. That's great fun. But the freshwater fish, I think there's nothing like the thrill of fishing for a trout with a light outfit, small fly, 5X leader, light rod. You throw you're out on a beautiful stream, weather's nice, you're all alone, you cast and cast to a certain place where the fish are rising, and all of a sudden there's a flash of silver and black, and the line tightens up and the reel starts to scream and the fish jumps, and that's the ultimate, I think. That and the Atlantic salmon, which is fished for in the stream, so it's actually freshwater fishing. Those are the two greatest thrills in fishing, I think, the Atlantic salmon and the rainbow trout, or the steelhead.
I haven't tried that, but I do deep sea fish.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's nothing like having fish on, you know, and go. We have a cruise every year that we...
You go for the salmon off
Oregon coast? Yeah, off the Oregon coast.
Uh-huh. Well, I've done a lot of that off Puget Sound and up towards Tatoosh Island and then up towards Alaska and the Inland Passage, stopping in all those bays, Rivers Inlet and Bella Coola and Bella Bella and Prince Rupert and... Ketchikan, Queen Charlotte Islands, but that's a little more static. You fish with a troll, or you fish, you mooch with the cut herring or a plug. It's not anything like fishing with a light rod on a stream. You get a 20-pound Atlantic salmon on a light rod and a fly on a brawling river, and you got some action in a canoe.
Yeah.
Up and down the rapids, trying to maneuver the canoe around, finally get the salmon into some still water where you can fight him sensibly, you know.
Right. Ben, you live in Hillsboro. I suppose a lot of people think you still live in Hollywood. It's a very lovely area, surrounded by eucalyptus trees, and you've lived here quite a while.
I think 11 years now, John. I moved up here because I had always come here by the theaters here, and we used to do about 50% of our radio shows up here at the Marine Memorial at Auditorium to get a new audience, you know, to get a new life into the show. And I developed lots of friendships here, played a lot of golf here, and did a lot of fishing and duck shooting around here, and it always seemed to me to be a nice area to live. So when things calmed down a little and the children had arrived, I thought this would be a nice place to come and dig in permanently, which is what I've done.
And you're out
of... I can commute back to Hollywood. You can get down there in 55 minutes.
Oh, sure.
And I keep a wardrobe down there, so I don't have to take any luggage. I just get off the plane, and my man meets me, and Leo Lynn, and I'm on the set an hour and a half after I've left Hillsboro.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're doing this series of interviews in your study. Do you have a trophy room?
Well,
the Oscar is
As I've told you, most of the things are up at the Crosby Library in Gonzaga. But you see around the roof here a lot of trophies. They're mostly golf, fishing trophies, a couple of some plaques, and then there's the 21 gold records up there in a frame, and a lot of horse racing trophies, golf trophies, quite a few things. But as I say, most of them are up in the Gonzaga Library. I have the Oscar downstairs, I think, on the, in the library, prominently displayed.
Well,
and proudly.
I would think so.
Artifacts of all kinds are dangling around here, and what they all are.
The day when you won the Oscar, Bing, we weren't having all these actors refusing to accept their honors. George Scott and Marlon Brando.
Well, I thought George Scott did it better. He just announced at the beginning he wasn't going to appear, and that's his prerogative, I guess. He's a marvelous actor, incidentally. I think George Scott's got to be the most arresting, dynamic actor I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Just simply tremendous. And so is Marlon Brando. Marlon Brando, I think, if he wanted to turn down that Oscar, he should have come and said, "This, because of my beliefs, that I just can't honestly accept this Oscar." I think everybody would have appreciated his position.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he had to send that little Indian girl who was scared out of her wits.
Well, I know, this seems to be a time for causes.
Mm-hmm. Well, he can have a cause. He's entitled to a cause. But I think he should have come personally and said exactly why, briefly, and said that this isn't in accord with my beliefs, the acceptance of this. And everybody would have said, well, that's fine. You're entitled to that.
I agree with you. Do you, where are all the Crosbys, the offspring at this point? You have a family, two families, you got the four boys.
And they're all young men now,
boys. Yeah.
The, Gary's lives in Westwood, down near Hollywood. He, very active in all facets of television, recording. He became quite a dramatic actor, and I believe a good one. Philip plays the nightclubs. He made many trips out to the, Vietnam, entertaining. He developed quite an act. Took a lot of shows out there. Dennis is interested in three or four things. He is connected with a fishing outfit, commercial fishing. They have some vessels down off Baja California, and they're canning the product. He's also interested in a sound system called Quadraphonics, and that keeps him pretty busy. And Lindsay has horses. He rents to Western people that make westerns for television and for the films, and he works in some of these westerns too. So that takes in their activities. They all have children, and they're quite settled down now. They had some wild years, as we all do, and now that you wouldn't know their opinions and their attitudes. Gary is very much interested in Little League baseball and basketball, children's athletics of all kinds. Very busy.
Mm-hmm. Now then, the current family, I understand your daughter is a great sharpshooter. She's very good
on
a safari.
I took her on a safari, and I took her first down to the Pacific Rod and Gun Club down here at Westlake, where they have a skeet and trap, and I got an instructor. And he showed her how to hold a shotgun and how to mount the gun and everything about it, and let her fire it a couple times, and then he threw a few... skeet for, and I think she got 18 out of 25, a fantastic performance. Nobody could believe it. And, of course, after that, she didn't do so well for the next two or three lessons, maybe 12, and then she went back up again, and when went to Africa, she was pretty good, and she shot very well down there with a shotgun. And then she had a chance to shoot this crocodile. It was in the papers, a big crocodile on the Tana River. He was a man-eater. He'd killed two or three people they knew about. The river is full of crocodiles, but this one was a big one, and he was quite predatory, and the natives had told our professional hunter all about him, so they made a trip up there. She took a shot at him and missed, and she was quite discouraged. Hard you have to stalk these beasts. They lay up on the sand in the sun, but if they see any movement on the bank or anything, they flip in the river like lightning. Second time up, she got him, and he was 13 feet 6 long.
Oh, boy.
And she wanted to hide for a handbag, but I think she's got enough for a steamer trunk.
And the others? The other children?
Well, Harry is busy with a variety of pursuits. I've never seen a young fellow. He's 14. He's become quite good on the guitar, John, but he's funny. He's never satisfied with the way he plays any certain song. He changes it every time he plays it with new, more inventive harmonies. And he goes to a fellow for once a week for study harmony and composition. He's written three or four things. His mother wrote the lyrics for them. And at high school, he plays the guitar for all the convocations and the meetings and everything of the student body. And he plays piano pretty good, all by ear. He's written some things for the piano. But he's strange. He never seems to play anything the same way twice, which I told him is a mistake. I remember all the great musicians that I've worked with, like Beiderbecke and the Dorseys and Venutis and the Langs, when they got a thing that was pretty good, a chorus, well, they played it and they stuck with it. They used it that way. They knew it was good and why fool with it?
Yeah.
He'll get around to that, I hope. And he's a good shot. Loves to shoot ducks. Good duck shot, good trap shot, skeet shot. Very good rifle shot. He's been on safari where he did well. He has a very good Labrador. I've raised Labradors for about 35 years, had innumerable litters. And the last litter I had, I told him he could have the pick, and he picked a male. And it turned out to be the best dog I've ever raised.
Oh,
I'm trying to get it back, but it's futile, I think. This is a marvelous Labrador. Big dog, must weigh 90 pounds. Eager and keen, good nose. A lot of desire, everything you want of a Labrador. And he's a great golfer. Well, great, you know, for a kid 14. He's broken 80 once. He's around the low 80s all the time. And any time he's not busy with something else, he's over at the golf course, which is only 10 minutes away, hitting balls or with a bag on his shoulder, playing a few holes. And I play with him maybe once a week. He's about a, I would say, a good 10 handicap. He's on the high school golf team. And he and two other kids have lately got themselves in business, two of kids of his age. They conceived the idea of a diner's guide, and they went to United Airlines. They have commuter flights between Los Angeles and San Francisco, I think about 10 or 12 a day. And putting this diner's guide on the airlines as a giveaway, put it in the seat pocket. And he got the United Airlines interested. He went and made a call on the fellow who represents that particular department, and he got the nod to go ahead, and they've developed this brochure now, and they've called on some restaurants in both San Francisco and Los Angeles. They want to get the top restaurants, charge them so much for the space, and then get enough money out of the advertising to pay for the printing and the color work and the artwork. They're going to go ahead because United has given them the okay. Well, you can see that's quite a few activities for a 14-year-old. Hopefully it'll keep him from straying into less attractive paths.
Does he ever play guitar while you sing?
Yes, we used him on television once or twice, and practically every evening he comes in with his guitar and we try a few things. He's now working, he's kind of hooked on bossa nova. That and the Segovia, and he plays a few popular things that he sings himself. Let's see what other kind of music he plays. Bach, he plays a little Bach.
Oh, yeah.
Very little. But he's an inventive kind of a guitar player. He's always trying new things. I hope he finds something that a vein that the leader likes and latch onto that and pursue it. And Mary Frances is with the ballet five days a week. She's just been over in Marin County where they had the annual ballet festival. There was 29 companies from all over the Pacific Coast down there. From Seattle, I think they sent their company down. And they had a three-day festival of ballet, and she was came home just to full of stories of what she saw and how exciting it was and how much she learned and how much more she appreciates the ballet now. And that and her tennis, she plays tennis, and that keeps her busy enough with schoolwork. Nathaniel's a sports addict, as I think I've told you. Follows all the sports, all the sporting magazines and sport news and everything relating to sports. Pittsburgh is his baseball team and the Vikings are his football team.
Well, I don't think your kids are any more unusual than anybody else's. My son, I was a little older than yours, is than Harry is playing guitar. He doesn't know. But he's listening to classical music.
Yeah.
And I think they go through a phase, really, and then they'll settle down to
Find some vein and pursue that. Of course, Nathaniel's plays in the Little League. Came home desolate the other day. They got beat 15-16.
Our team got beat, too, the other day.
Pitchers do, 16-15. But he said he got three hits out of seven. Pretty good. And he's a pretty good athlete. He jogs every day. He's concerned about whether he's going to be big enough. Every day he weighs himself. He asks me what I think about how big he's going to be. And I can't be very encouraging because I'm not very tall and his mother's not very tall. But he has an aunt who, for a girl, is tall. She's 5'8", and he has an uncle who's 6 feet, so maybe he's got a chance, but he's so hopeful that he'll be large enough to participate on the collegiate or professional level.
Yeah, well, let's hope he will be. Yeah. I'm going to...
Bing, on our Christmas show today, we're playing a lot of Christmas music that you've done with a number of people, including the Andrews sisters.
Mm-hmm.
You made a lot of recordings with them, but you also did some...
what do you got with them, the Jingle Bells?
Jingle Bells, yeah. And also Merry Karikimaka.
Oh, yeah, that's a way of saying Merry Christmas in Hawaiian.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And did you enjoy working with the Andrews sisters?
They were great girls, really wonderful girls. Patty had a marvelous sense of humor, always kidding and rimming. And the other two girls were real pleasant, very, very wonderful people to be with and be around and to work with, and tremendously talented, too. And a style that was unique.
You had them on your show a number of times.
They had a great conductor and arranger, Dick Schoen, who really understood the way they worked, and the things he did for us together were his arrangements, I think, were responsible in great part for the success of the records. He really knew how to routine an arrangement, so it had a beginning and a middle and a real climax at the end. It rode out strong, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, we opened with Jingle Bells, so let's go into another one, Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
Oh, yeah.
Silver Bells was done with a girl named Carol Richards. And just for your information, she had a rather interesting history, I think. She was a Minneapolis, Minnesota girl.
Yeah.
And we were doing a show at a club, and she won a Bob Hope talent contest.
Yeah.
And we had her on our show. And then Bob Hope brought her out to Hollywood to be on his show, and she appeared. In fact, you made a couple of records with her.
Yeah, well, I recorded with her, not on the basis of Hope's recommendation, because that would be a positive knock, but on the basis of her real ability and real talent. She was a lovely girl.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Silver Bells is a lovely Christmas song. You gave a kind of Yuletide nod to the old sod of Erin with Christmas in Killarney.
Ah, yes, Christmas in Killarney. Mm-hmm. And, we thought we ought to have. We've got Christmas songs of every type and from every nation. We thought certainly Ireland, which is so musical, should have a representative in the category.
I have a feeling, Bing, that Do You Hear What I Hear was probably your second greatest Christmas hit, next to White Christmas.
Gee, I don't know, John. I couldn't say.
It did.
How about I'll Be Home for Christmas, or some of those things? They went rather well.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're probably right, yeah.
It's it was a more recent song, and of course the Harry Simeon Chorale picked it up, and so did everybody else, I guess. But you introduced it. I understand you were somewhat reluctant to record the traditional hymns of Christmas.
I didn't think that religious things should be commercialized, but Jack Capp, who is a very persuasive, convinced me, and the royalties from Silent Night and the Nesta Fidelis always went to charity anyhow, so I didn't commercialize on it, really, and they were beautiful songs and should be recorded. So I'm glad I did them now.
Did you ever get criticized for your interpretation of them?
Oh, yes, from all sides. My pronunciation of the Latin. And I always thought I had a pretty good Latin pronunciation. You know, 8 years with the Jesuits, and they emphasized Latin. I thought I could make it all right.
Your most recent album of Christmas music was A Time to Be Jolly, which was produced by Sonny Burke,
yeah.
Yes. And you had Jack O'Halloran and the Voices of Christmas, and I think he had done some earlier things with you.
I've done a lot of work with Jack through the years, both on the radio and the television and on records and with his groups. He's very prominent in Hollywood with his vocal arrangements and his vocal choruses. He works a lot on everybody's show and on everybody's records.
I think one of the interesting things, being about the Time to Be Jolly album, some of the songs had introductions, lead-ins of the Burt, you know, the Alfred Burt carols.
Yeah.
Done by the singers.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea, I think. Yeah, very effective.
Your songs of Christmas have not only had an impact at home, but also abroad, and particularly during the war years. I know that White Christmas was a favorite of servicemen, but there were others, too.
Well, mostly servicemen, of course, during the war, because they were away from home, and it was Christmas time, and it had a poignant value, I guess, that it wouldn't otherwise achieve, and it was very successful, and sometimes I was reluctant to sing it, because it would put a rather sad note on the proceedings. Some of them, you could see tears in their eyes, and it reminded them of home and mother and the family, and the fact that they were so many thousand miles away, and in the middle of a terrible war.
Mm-hmm.
But it had a circulation, a currency in Germany and in France and in Italy because it's such a great song. Any place that it's been heard, that song, no matter who sang it, was immediately successful.
You've been called the voice of Christmas. Did you know that?
I don't think that's quite accurate. Everybody sings as many Christmas songs as I did. I was lucky in maybe getting some particularly good songs that the other guys didn't get, like things by Berlin and other people of similar caliber. And maybe that's why they think that I'm associated with Christmas a little more closely than most singers, but I don't think it's quite correct.
Well, I like it.
No. Very cool. I had a lot of Christmas here.
I never pass a Christmas without having your albums going on Christmas Day.
Well, I'm grateful, John.
Bing, what are some of your own favorite Christmas songs and the people who do them?
I always thought Nat Cole's record of, Christmas, Christmas, on the Christmas.
Oh, the Christmas, Christmas song.
That's a great piece of material, and he did it marvelous with just the right quality of delivery. He didn't dramatize it or anything. It was plaintive.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought Nat was one of the greatest singers we ever had. He was, I always like to describe him as sort of a strolling player. He just sang along, and there it was, and if you liked it, fine. And no pressure, no attempt to really sell a song, but it was there. The sale was consummated as soon as he started singing. A marvelous style, and a great man.
Well, it's proved by the fact that stations still play his records quite a good deal.
Yeah.
I know we do. The Christmas song was written by Mel Torme.
Mel Torme, who's a marvelous musician. I have great admiration for Mel. He's written some great things. He's a thorough musician. He can arrange for an orchestra or for a vocal choir. He's got great taste. I think he's one of the best singers we've ever had.
Mm-hmm. And he's not appreciated, I don't think.
Not at all. I can't understand why.
How does the Crosby family spend Christmas?
Oh, it's generally some of the relatives are here. Catherine's sister lives nearby with two boys, and they're around, and possibly one or two of my boys drops in sometimes during the week, and Catherine has her father. If he's available, it's a kind of an open house for 3 or 4 days.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you help trim the tree?
I kind of supervise.
Oh, you supervise.
It's a big program, trimming the tree in our house. They get a good-sized tree, but they make all their own ornaments, Catherine and the children, from Christmas cards that they've received, particularly attractive or prominent Christmas cards from prominent people. We like to use a little name dropping on the tree, but they make a lot of them out of styrofoam and beads, and they generally put a picture of some relative or some friend, like Catherine's mother or my father, and inside the styrofoam, and it's a ball, and it's quite a tree when they get through with it. It's a couple days' work for them to really hang the tree.
Do you lead in some carol singing then?
During the trimming?
Or after?
When it's finished, we just generally have a little celebration.
A little song fest. Mm.
The tree is finished. It's an event.
I have a recording, Bing, that you made back in 1950 with the other family, the four boys.
What's the record?
Which was called A Crosby Christmas.
Sure.
I think it might be fun to listen to. Gary, Dennis, Lindsay, and Philip. Some of them did solos, and I think you did a couple with Gary.
Slip that on there.
I will. We'll close today with White Christmas, Bing, but before we do, maybe you have a sort of seasonal greeting you'd like to pass on to our listeners.
I certainly would. I take great pleasure in this opportunity to wish everyone who listens to this program, everyone in Oregon, a Merry Christmas and a very happy and prosperous New Year.
And same to you, Bing. Okay, now I have a few additional things here. Bing, one thing that I didn't realize is that you have a mast, and it is a mast, I guess, because I think you're the only singer who's done it, 2 platinum discs. I know you've got a lot of gold discs.
What are they for?
For selling...
I know I got them, but I can't think what it's...
300 million records. You got it in 1960.
Yeah,
and some 400 million around the world in 1970. You got it for a second.
You believe those figures, John?
Your brother Larry gave them to
him. Well, my brother Larry, he carries a pocket full of clippings, and he's always ready to substantiate his claims. He's a very loyal supporter. It seems like an extravagant figure to me, but I'll accept it.
Well, in London, a man named Ralph Hartman, I believe his name is.
Harding.
Ralph Harding
has probably done the most complete discography on your work of anybody I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
It's all mimeographed.
Uh-huh.
But he's got every record that you made up, I think, to 1971, not only the song, but every different recording that was made of it and put out on it.
Uh-huh.
And I would think that that's a pretty good start toward the 400 million, whatever.
He's very assiduous, those English record collectors. If they go into something like that, they do it with complete thoroughness. They were all upset not too long ago because it looked like a year was going to go by without the issuance of one of my records. Mm-hmm. They made such a furore and such a foo-furore that I finally made a record of a song from the musical show Seesaw called It's Not Where You Start, It's Where You Finish, and we backed it up with Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around That Old Oak Tree. So
yeah.
Their wish was granted, and a year has not passed without some sort of a record being issued. Whether or not it does anything or not is immaterial. It's just that they figure that I got to have something out every year.
Something every year.
Yeah.
Well, somebody told me one of these, they call themselves Bing Nuts every so often.
Bing
Nuts. Collectors,
yeah.
Yeah. Told me that you recorded that without accompaniment initially, and that they put several different accompaniments to these.
No, I did it with a band down in Hollywood, a small jazz band. Sonny Burke produced it. I did hear later that they added some voices for the finish or for the second chorus or something, but I haven't heard that particular rendition.
You also have recorded a few things rather privately, like your safaris your friends and so forth.
Yeah, I've done 9 safaris, and I always write what we call a parody or a medley of songs about the people on the safari, some of the funny things that happened or some of the epic things that happened, and give them each a record and a tape so they can have a souvenir of what was a very festive occasion.
Are they playable on the air?
Yeah, they're clean.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There might be a couple of things that are, judged by today's standards, they'd be just like Sesame Street.
Did you have any particular rivalry with Frank Sinatra when he began, appealing to the Bobby Soxers and so forth?
Oh, I think the press dreamed up sort of a rivalry. We were great friends, always have been. He appealed to a different audience, and he sang different kind of songs, and some of them were the same. We didn't clash in any way.
Mm-hmm. He's come out of retirement now.
Yeah, Blue Eyes is back.
He's
got I thought that was inevitable. I didn't think he'd ever lay doggo for long. He likes the action. He likes to be on the public scene and working before audiences, and he couldn't possibly endure retirement. He's only 50-something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to see him back, and I've heard some excerpts from that album.
Hell of an album. Yeah, I read a review in one of the San Francisco papers. They really give it a big send-off. He worked hard on it, I'll bet. Bing,
at this particular point, we're talking about Going My Way, which, of course, was the big picture for you, and the song, Swinging on a Star, won an Academy Award as the best song of the year, and I understand it came from a phrase that you used on one of your youngsters. He was a little stubborn, and you asked him if he wanted to be a mule, and that gave the songwriters the cue for what they were trying to find.
Well, that's what Johnny Burke told me, but he's such a great writer, and he's so inventive that I really doubt the veracity of that. But it sounds reasonable. I did say something like that at different times to the kids.
Great song.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any reluctance about playing a priest?
Yes, I did. I didn't see how it would possibly be accepted. Coming from a Jesuit school, you have a respect for priests, you know, and you admire them for the sacrifices they've made in order to discharge their vocation. I couldn't see how a crooner, who was established as a crooner and a singer of love songs and jazz, could possibly be a priest, but the head of the studio at that time, Buddy DeSilva, convinced me, and so did Leo McCary, who directed the picture, that I ought to try it, so I did.
Bing, you made a recording at one point saluting the state of Oregon. Do you remember that? It was Holiday in Oregon.
No.
Yeah.
Was it in a picture?
No, it wasn't in a picture. It was a special disc that was put out by the telephone company, Pacific Northwest Bell, to celebrate, I think, Oregon's centennial.
Who wrote it? Somebody up in Oregon,
I guess. Yeah, somebody wrote it, and you did a narrative thing on it and sang a little bit about the glories of Oregon.
Have you heard it?
Yes, I've got it.
Oh, no.
And we're going to play it.
I wish I was there to hear it.
You will when you get the tape.
Uh-huh.
How do you feel about the changing public taste in films these days and the greater use of minority people and so forth?
How do you mean greater use of minority people?
Well, we're using more, there are more black films.
Oh, you mean
this kind of thing?
Well, that's fine with me. Everybody should get a shot at it, no matter what their background, race, religion, creed, or anything else.
You know, some of the films that you made earlier on, you used blacks quite frequently in them, and in listening to some of the recordings made from those films, things have changed quite a good deal today for
indeed.
The better.
Oh, indeed they have, I agree, quite true.
How about the public tastes in films, the kind of films they're looking at today?
Well, I think the entertainment industry has a great deal to be responsible for, accountable for. They've gone too far. I'm hopeful it's just a phase, and it seems to be waning now. I don't think it's good for children to see all this explicit sex, nudity. Profanity, I don't object to too much. It's a shock to hear it. But it's the portraying explicit sex as an attractive thing and a sophisticated thing. The young mind, if it's susceptible, thinks it's a smart thing to do and a clever thing to do, to act and behave that way, and permissiveness never bred a healthy society and never will. But I think it's going to die out. How far can they go? They've done it all. It's got to be, it's getting a little boring, really.
I think so. Do you remember the date, the year that you had the dedication of the Crosby Library? And
When
was
that? The date? Oh, I couldn't tell you. It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you.
No, I can find out. One of the things people have asked me since our earlier chats together, Bing, is do you ever talk to him about those Minute Maid commercials where he's swinging in a hammock and drinking orange juice?
Well, damn, I have a sort of a connection with Minute Maid for years. When they first discovered this orange concentrate and how they could deep freeze it and keep it, I went on the radio for them for about a year, and I had a little block of stock, and the Minute Maid was successful, the product, and the stock went up, and when it reached an attractive figure, I sold it. And I've never had any further connection with Minute Maid except that association, but I knew the people that started it, and so I do these little things just out of gratitude, really.
Well, you get more comment, or I've heard
everybody
more comment.
Everybody thinks I'm a big stockholder or something in Minute Maid, which is not true. I think it's very good orange juice, incidentally.
It is. Mm-hmm. I also, don't they put out Orange Plus?
Yeah, they make a lemonade and various things. Yeah.
The Orange Plus is the one I like because it has those little pieces of orange in it. It's very. Now we've done a nice commercial for Minute Maid.
I hope they're happy.
Bing, I'm just going to throw some names at you. This is the final bunch here. I just like some of your impressions of the people you've worked with that we can scatter through the show. Louis Armstrong.
A great man and a tremendous artist. Unique stylist. Lots of people imitate him, but nobody's ever been quite able to play cornet or trumpet the way he did. And he was lots of fun to be with. Jolly, jovial, convivial. I loved the man. I really did. And admired him greatly, and I think I heard him way back in 26, 27 when he was around Chicago with King Oliver.
You enjoyed working with him, too.
Yeah, I sure did.
Several of your pictures.
He was always fun. And he used to send me postcards from all over the world. I remember once I got a postcard from him. He was up in Stockholm. He said, dear Pops, he always called me Pops, this is the scolinest country I've ever been in. I'm the scolinest cat here.
Judy Garland.
One of the greatest talents I've ever been associated with. She could do so many things and do them well. Great singer, accomplished dancer, really could hoof, buck and wing, any kind of style you wanted. A good dramatic actress, and a wonderful comedian. I don't think that her talents as a comedian were ever fully appreciated, but she could do hokey comedy, baggy pants comedy, drawing room comedy, marvelous sense of humor. I think a lot of people probably think of her more in terms of a tragedian because of her tragic life, and she did a lot of serious pictures too, and there are pictures with Andy Hardy where she was just a slip of a girl, but actually she was an accomplished comedian. I think she was a better comedian than Lucille Ball. And she could do so many things so well, and a great girl to be with, full of fun stories, marvelous companion and on a picture, on a radio show, or on a television show. There was always lots of laughs.
She filled in for you on one program. I think that was at the time that Dixie...
We did a lot of shows together. But as I say, I think people associate her with tragedy and drama because of the way she wound up, which is sad because she really was a lovely, fun girl to be with.
Ella Fitzgerald.
You picked out some of the tough people, I'll say that. She stands alone, you know, for many reasons. Sings any kind of a song. I think the scat singing that she does is uniquely hers, and nobody comes close to it. You can just go around a chord like an accomplished jazz musician and hit notes and finishes and climaxes like she's playing a saxophone or a cornet or something. And a great lady, too, just as simple and uncomplicated a woman as you've ever met in your life. Lovely lady.
Connie Boswell.
Great little girl.
Hello. Dear John, answering the questions which were contained in your recent letter, here are the following replies. Yes, John, we cut an album in London last year called That's What Life Is All About. This title song was written by Ken Barnes. And actually, I wrote some of the lyrics. I will tell you which ones, because I'd like you to think they were the good ones. I suppose you might consider this song to be a summation of my philosophy, if I have any. If I do, it's certainly not anything very profound. But it is partially descriptive, I guess. In 1972, John, there was a great show on Broadway called Pippin. Stephen Schwartz wrote the score, and I particularly liked the song called No Time At All. I used it on television a couple of times with some success, once on a show with Pearl Bailey and Bob Hull. And this particular song is included in the album that we cut in London last year. Johnny Mercer, my favorite lyric writer, joined forces with Andrew Previn that year, John, to write and produce a show in London called, quote, The Good Companions. It was based on a book by J.B. Priestley. And we put in a couple of songs that John helped me on, singing and writing. This one I thought was rather a good opening. It has a bit of Harry Lauder tossed in, which might be appealing to some of the oldsters. The title song, Johnny and I got together on it for one of the albums we recorded in London last year. As I said, Andrew Previn wrote the music. Oh, there were so many good songs available that year, John. And I recorded some of them, too. Let's see. Well, here's one you might like. It's another Johnny Mercer song, and it was written for a show by Johnny and Bobby Dolan. Bobby Dolan used to be director of music at Paramount, was for many years, and produced a couple of pictures that I was in when I was under contract there. Bobby was a conductor, great pianist, songwriter, arranger, thorough musician. I put it in the album because, well, I thought it was an amusing song, and it had kind of an old-time vaudeville flavor to it, too. All this concert we did in Los Angeles, it went rather well, I thought, John. The audience was very kind, very receptive, demonstrative, seemed to indicate their approval. Didn't have a great deal of rehearsal because the family was all distributed in various parts of the Western Hemisphere. Mary Frances in Texas, Harry was working in Mexico with a guitar teacher, and Nathaniel was busy on the golf course. Never did get on the stage until it was time to do the show, which made it a little rough, of course, but the audience seemed to understand our problem. And they made us really feel like we were doing something first class. I did the same concert in Monterey. We did it in Houston, and we're going to do it in San Francisco, and then we go over to London for a couple of weeks at the Palladium. And we may do a concert in Frankfurt and one in Amsterdam, one in Dublin and Edinburgh. Mrs. Crosby's going to be in Edinburgh doing a play during the Edinburgh Festival, a play called The Heiress. Real nice show, I think. We're going to do 2 weeks at the Palladium, yeah. 12 shows, I think. We may throw in an extra show because the we finish on July 3rd, and we may do a show on July 4th because of the bicentennial, and maybe the United States Embassy in London will want to do something special, like have a visit from our new ambassadress, I guess that's what you call a lady ambassador, Anne Armstrong, who happens to be a personal friend of mine and Catherine's, and who I think is going to make a very good representative for the United States over there in London. And maybe the July 4th we can put something together. We'll have a little patriotic flavor to it. I think they're cooking something up now, and I don't know just what plans will eventually develop. Oh, no, this is not the first time I've ever done a performance abroad. I've done a great many of them. I did a couple of Red Cross shows in Paris, in Brussels. I did one in Cannes. Done a lot of shows in Germany. Not so many concerts, but little impromptu performances at golf tournaments or at banquets. Most of them were charity things. I never did work for pay on the stage in England. I did some charity benefits with Hope. In fact, played the Palladium one night with Hope. Of course, truthfully, I haven't done a great deal of concert work. Not when you compare what I've done with what most people of my generation have done. People like Hope, he's constantly appearing somewhere. Conventions, political rallies, circuses, bus stops, market openings. Not that I don't like concert work, it's just that I had enough work doing what I was doing, and I never really put together an act that was organized. Anything that would be acceptable. I just don't like to step out and say, and here's one of my hit songs, sing six or seven of those, and then take a bow and get off. You've got to have an organized act, a routine, and some help, too. Oh, I don't think that picture that you mentioned will be done this summer, John. I don't think there's much chance of it. They have a treatment. You know what a treatment is? It's just sort of a synopsis of what the script eventually will turn out to be. We rather liked what we saw, and the writer, the fellow who submitted the script, is trying to pep it up, pump some insanity into it, some wild comedy, like some of the Marty Feldman, Monty Python, Blake Edwards, Pink Panther type materials. Pictures like that, Hope thinks it needs it, and I agree. And if he can do this, or get something in it that's funny, and amusing, wild, eccentric, unusual, bizarre, well, we might do it in the fall. Oh, Liza Minnelli, what a girl. One of the most professional ladies I've ever worked with, and one of the most talented. She knows her business thoroughly. She always comes fully prepared, ready to shoot. It's a genuine pleasure working with this girl. She's kind, considerate of the crew. Everyone who works with us loves her. She has a delicious sense of humor. When we're not shooting a scene or rehearsing, she's clowning and kidding. Just a remarkably talented, agreeable, and appealing young lady. Well, I've never worked with Barbara Streisand, but I certainly think she's got a glorious voice, a tremendous range, lovely phrasing. She does it all, as far as a singer is concerned. Probably the best girl singer to come along in the last 20 years. Well, I don't know John Denver too well. I saw him once on television. Thought he was quite good, natural. A wholesome sort of appeal, sings well. I understand he writes his own songs. They're good tunes, too, very nice type, sort of an open-air, bucolic flavor. Clean, Western, nice songs. Elton John, I don't know anything about him at all, but I know he's a very big star. Just happens I've never heard him sing, nor have I ever seen him. Oh, I think Victor Moon sings beautifully. He has a real dramatic flair, too. Has a lot of stature in our business. I consider him a genuine artist. He's a good golfer, too. Mel Tormé, I think, is the greatest nightclub single I've ever seen work. I've long known of his musicianship. I worked with him when he had a group, singing group called the Meltones. We made some records. I think we worked on radio together, too. But his nightclub act, the one he's doing now, is one of the most exciting performances by a single that I've ever seen or heard. This fella has outstanding musicianship. He can play the piano, plays the drums, plays them both well, and he's such a thorough musician. His ad-libs and his phrasing are just inimitable. Amazing. Nobody I've ever heard can do what he can do. And he's a very agreeable fellow, too, a good friend of mine. Tor Lane, remarkable singer. Tremendous vocal dexterity. Never heard anybody like her. I've never seen her in person, but I have a couple of her albums. Certainly a genuine star. Very inventive. She has some marvelous musical innovations, phrases. Everything about her is exciting. She's a big, big star now, and she'll be so for a long time, I'm sure, because I understand she works very hard. She's very determined about everything she does. Oh, I really wouldn't be prepared to supply a satisfactory answer to the question about who would be the most popular top stars in popular music over the next decade. Well, surely some of the people we've been talking about, Cleo Lane, Barbra Streisand. I assume you're talking about people who record. John Denver, too, but there's so many of them. They're so great, so good. They come up every few months as a new one. They're all marvelous. I don't know how long some of them are going to endure. It's just a question of whether they can expand their repertoire and diversify, get into other kinds of music, other styles, other rhythms, other means of presentation, other deliveries. That'll determine how long they endure. There's so many new groups, it's difficult to keep up with them. The ones I've mentioned, the ones we've talked about here, I have heard, and I've heard often and I like. And I think they're all destined for a great deal of success. Well, John, I really consider it a great tribute to me that you've done. You've gone to such extensive pains and so much trouble to put together this 26 weeks of entertainment based on my performances through the years. Gee, I hope you just haven't worn out my welcome up there with all my friends up in the Pacific Northwest and in the Oregon Territory. It was always a pleasure to see you when you came down to California to visit and tape these little introductions and comments that you thought would be essential. I had a lot of nice comment from people up in that part of the world who heard the programs. They told me how much they liked it and the way you handled it. And from listening to the tapes you sent me, I must say that you've done a remarkable piece of work. Great editing job. These things are not easy to do. Must have taken a great deal of time. And I thank you. Thank you so much, John, and thanks to all the fans up there, all the friends who have listened, who have written to me, and who have expressed their approval of the series. Believe me to be always your friend, Bing Crosby.
You've been quoted to the effect that you have no great talent as an actor, but a hell of a good ear for music.
Well, do you want me to confirm that or deny it?
Either way. You won an Academy Award, and
they don't give you that for a good ear.
No.
I think that's a popularity contest, the Academy Award, and I had some friends that year. Most of my enemies have gone to war. But I suppose I got a good ear. Yeah, my father had a good ear for music, played the guitar. My mother had a good ear and sang, so I inherited a good ear. And I think I can tell when I'm out of tune, all right.
Well, did you think that after you had done Going My Way, and I think particularly The Country Girl, that maybe you were a pretty good actor, too?
No, I never did feel that. I think the part carried me, or the director. Those were extremely good parts. And the director in each case was one of the greats, you know. And they just had me do things. I didn't know what I was doing, and just did what they said. I don't think I'll ever be a great actor when you think of actors, when you think of Olivier and Redford and Newman, all the fine actors we have. I never will be able to act when you think of the things they do.
Your autobiography was titled Call Me Lucky, and perhaps luck did have a lot to do with your success because you came along at the sort of the confluence of when movies found their voice and radio was beginning to develop network-wise. And but did luck really have all that much to do with it?
It played a big part. I could look back on all kinds of turning points, you know, where I just did this instead of that and advanced myself for no reason. You know, I'd run into somebody who helped me that I'd ever expect to encounter. I always was a good listener. And if I did run into somebody who made what sounded like a good suggestion, I was ready to accept it because I didn't know what I was doing. I was having a good time. I was doing what I liked to do. I was singing, and I was working with famous musicians, you know, jazz musicians, guys who I revered. And if it turned out well, that was a bonus. I didn't have any intent to get anywhere, really.
When you and the Rhythm Boys were with the Whiteman Orchestra, did you have any idea you might go on to such a thing as stardom?
No, of course not. I thought we'd have try to put together a good vaudeville act, because I love vaudeville, and sell some records. But I had no idea of being a soloist then.
Everything you do seems to be so effortless, and that's part of your stock in trade. Has it really been that easy?
Yeah, I think so. It really has been. I can't think of that. There's times on pictures when you got into scenes that were hard, difficult and tricky, and you work long hours and get a little tired and a little discouraged and a little petulant, maybe. But I can't think of any great trials or travail. Or...
Can you think of the toughest professional task you ever faced?
No, I really can't. I mean, I've tried things that I couldn't come up with, couldn't carry off. And I said, well, that just, it didn't crush me. I just felt, well, I just don't have that particular talent.
You were one of the last of the big name stars to leave radio. Did you have a kind of affinity for radio that escaped you on television?
No, I had a good deal on radio. And television wasn't too attractive then, money-wise. And it was harder, a lot harder. You know, radio, you go down your old clothes and they hand you a script and away you go. Television, you had to get made up in the wardrobe, and it was live then. If you made a mistake, it was irretrievable. You were gone. I just, until they got into taping, and I never really got interested in it.
You're inclined to disavow your influence on singing styles of others, and yet you're accorded the status of the master among most of today's popular singers. Isn't that something of which to be proud?
Well, I'm proud if it would be true, but it's not true, really, John. I copied from, as I say, Jolson, Georgie Price, Van and Skank, Gene Austin, Ukulele Ike, all those people that I listened to. I picked up a little here and there. Ethel Waters. I don't see anybody sounds like me at all. To me, they don't. Anybody that sings the kind of a song I sing, that's going to be compared, because maybe I sang that song. So they say, well, he's singing it and he's singing it. Who do you like better? But I don't see any basis for comparison between what I do and anybody else. If we're singing the same keys, if you're singing the same keys, you're going to sound alike. Let's see if I can think of anybody that really sounds alike. Dean Martin, a little bit. He sometimes phrases like I do. And sometimes I can listen and his voice sounds like mine. But only slightly. He has his own real style. He has a style of his own. It's kind of a breathless style. I can't think of anybody else that sounds like me. Who do you think sounds like me?
Well, of course, Dick Todd, I think,
sounds like Todd.
You and a few of those back in those days. I agree with you on Dean Martin. In fact, he made a recording called If I Could Sing Like Bing.
He did?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I see and heard impressionists like Rich Little. He can sing like me. And Sammy Davis can sing like me. Who else? Gershwin?
Frank Gershwin.
Any of those good impressionists can sing like any singer, anybody they want to imitate. And they sound like me. But I've never heard any singer that's popular that sounds like me except Dean, only slightly.
Do you read music at all?
In a way. If I'm rehearsing with a couple of other singers and I've got a copy of the music and they give me if they start the first note and I can hit it with them, then by going up and down, I can approximate it. But actually, popular songs are written kind of conventionally. You know where the next notes are going to be, almost. I think if I hear it once, I can do it without. And just with the help of watching those notes go up and down. And I tell the value of a note. You know, the one that is empty, you give him a little more time than you do the one that's blacked out. You kind of skip him. And if it's got a few little flags on it, you just... really give him a lick and a promise and go on.
Is the reason you don't do more of the up-to-date contemporary music the fact that a lot of it is so complicated?
Oh, no. I've tried a few of them. They are harder to learn because I'm setting that regular eight bars release and eight bars and out. But I can learn them if I listen to them a few times. I just have to hear them a few more times than the others.
Do you consider yourself a perfectionist?
No, I'm very sloppy. If I get something that sounds pretty good to me, and maybe the recording engineer and the producers hollering one more, I say, no, well, that's good enough. Once in a while, I level on something that I think needs... I wouldn't let anything go through that I thought was lousy, no. But sometimes the changes they suggest are not too important, and the improvements that they want to achieve aren't really vital. And maybe I'm in a hurry to get somewhere about to play golf or something. And, you know... Nowadays, you got to work. I do six numbers in 3 hours. And that's kind of crowding it a bit. If you fool around and try to get everything just letter perfect, You're going to run into overtime, and with musicians now into overtime and golden hours, it's very expensive.
Hmm. Was there a turning point in your musical career, a point at which you began to take it seriously, or didn't you ever, or became highly critical of the material you recorded?
I don't think I ever was critical, no. I just took material that some of the song pluggers, I valued their opinion. Some of the real great song pluggers in the East who were entertainers themselves and became song pluggers, they call them musical exploiters or something in those days, they kid them. But they were all guys who knew good songs. They were entertainers. And they brought you something that had just been written by a well-known writer, and they had confidence in it. I'd go along with that. And, of course, all the years I recorded under Jack Capp, I sang exactly what he wanted me to sing. I tried a few things of my own that laid bombs, real bombs that guys brought me. Just lately, I've been a little more discriminating, trying to find good songs and trying to get my voice in shape before I recorded. I didn't used to pay any attention to my voice. To my detriment, I'd sometimes go months without singing a note. I'd be on a hunting, fishing trip or safari or something without even uttering a note, and all of a sudden I'd come home and the recording date the next day.
Mm.
And your pipes are like any other muscle. They have to be used.
How do you feel about your singing voice today? Is it since your operation?
I think it's, well, the operation had nothing to do with the voice because the operation was on my chest and the back. I think it's better. I think I have more range now, more volume. I have a little more confidence because after the operation I was sedated for maybe 4 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, and I tried to smoke the pipe and the smoke tasted lousy. And the doctor didn't tell me to give up the pipe, but I laid it aside and never smoked it again. It's been almost 2 years now. And I don't miss it, and I think it that all those years I smoked were harmful to the voice, you know?
Well, your album output in 1975 was prodigious.
Well, I don't know if it was any good or not.
You did as
well,
many...
it was a lot of albums, but was it any good?
You did more albums than the average guy who is, you know, right at the top of the heap today does in 2 years' time. You could put you did more than Jerry Vale and Johnny Mathis combined.
Well, that's just the output, but there's a lot of work involved there, John. You figure each album would probably be 4 days' work.
Hmm.
So that's not a lot of work. Some rehearsal. And so your voice is not going to get tired. And but I think I sound better than I did 3 years ago.
You've covered the entire spectrum of music with the possible exception of Grand Opera and sold something around 400 million records. You've got a couple of platinum discs, according to your office. Nobody's achieved that. Does this give you a kind of feeling that perhaps you've created an American musical heritage of your own?
No, I never get that feeling. I'd have to dispute those figures because that couldn't be possible. I'll have to look at my receipts and see if I got paid off on that many. I don't believe that figure, no.
To interests other than music, you've done a lot of work in the fields of fish and the preservation.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw you on the Merv Griffin show. You made quite a pitch for it.
Mm-hmm.
Is this something to which the public can contribute somehow?
Well, the big thing that we're interested in now is a thing called the American League of Anglers. This is a group that's approached the problem more sensibly than any environmental group that I've become associated with, and I'm deeply concerned with two or three others. The one that's had the greatest success is Ducks Unlimited, who've done a tremendous job in the past 20 years by going up in Canada and recreating habitat that had been lost to encroachment by farms, cities, villages. Until now, they've put back, I think, 200 million acres of marshland, lakes, ponds, habitat, and they've brought the duck population, the wildfowl population, up to where it used to be. But getting back to the American League of Anglers, it's Ted Williams and Kirk Gowdy and a bunch of us. We figured out that a lot of the time these organizations are just spinning their wheels, trying to get anything done. The only place it can be done is in Washington with a lobby. Lobby is not a very pleasant word, although it's legal. And getting into politics is kind of unsavory nowadays. Doesn't seem like the right thing to do, but for this group, we thought it was the best. Because if you're in Washington, you can monitor the voting records of all the senators, the representatives, and you can tell their constituents how these people voted on things. You can influence their vote. If you can influence legislation that is up for both houses of Congress. For instance, we've been able to stop a dredging that was going on the Florida Keys that was ruining all the reefs further down. We stopped that. We've been instrumental in stopping some of the dredging and the pollution in the Hudson River to return the sea bass population back to what it used to be. Working on big things like that. The only fly in the ointment is that your donations to this are not tax deductible because lobbying is not a charitable enterprise. But that's the only way we're going to get any action. And it's really started out to really prove to be true. We've got a lot of work done and a lot of work to do. And that was the thing I was talking about on the Murph Griffin show. If you have any, I don't have the stationery here with the, where anybody can write to get to, but it's just the American League of Anglers, Washington, D.C. Maybe before you leave, I can give you the address and you can just put it, or lay it in there. Any donation's acceptable, and it's all going for what we think is a real useful, purposeful direction.
The other direction in which you go, you haven't got a book, but you wrote the foreword to it. It's a new book on the Crosby Pro-Am.
Oh, yeah.
I read a little bit of it last night and enjoyed it thoroughly, particularly about the entertainers and your son Lindsay saying that after one of your special clam bakes, you drove them all home, and he was asked why he allowed you to, and he said, "Well, you were the best of the lot, so, the best they had."
He said he was the best we had.
Yeah, but the Crosby Pro-Am, a couple of things about that. First of all, the money goes to charity, which is a youth charity.
And to student loan.
Yeah. And second thing is that, is it in trouble because PGA wants to get a little more honey off the pot?
Well, it's a yearly confrontation on that very theme. They, naturally, they're entertainers. They want all the money they can get. I'm an entertainer, and I can appreciate that point of view, but there's only so much we can give in order to make both ends meet down there. The problem is that we have about 700-800 people who work free. About 12 of them work all year around on part-time little things, committees. But 700 or 800 of them it takes to run the tournament. And they're businessmen, lawyers, people who live in the area who do it free because of the charities involved. Now, if it develops to a point that we have to pay the touring players more money than we take in and the charities don't get any money, these people are not going to do that work. We couldn't run a tournament without getting this free help from these men who voluntarily come out and help us out.
What is the youth forum?
A forum?
The youth fund?
A
fund.
We have a committee that processes appeals. And we mostly built youth recreation centers all over California and Hawaii and Arizona. And now we contribute toward their maintenance. And we went into hospitals and clinics and any kind of thing that needs a little money. But about 8-10 years ago, we went into student loans. We pick a small college in the United States. We now have about 65 of them. Colleges who don't have access to great big,
endowments.
Endowments.
Mm-hmm.
And we give them like $5,000-$10,000. And they apportion this out to students who are worthy and deserving and have merit and would be forced to drop out if they didn't have some help. And then the students pay it back when they graduate and get gainful employment. A lot of that money's come back, and it becomes a revolving fund.
It's been said of you that you're a very private man. What is your assessment of yourself?
I think that's a bad description. I think I'm a very public man. I travel all over the world. I fish, shoot, golf, go to the races, go to every sporting event. A private man sounds like a hermit.
Well, you're
a recluse.
Your butler, Alan Fisher, says that you're the most self-sufficient man he's ever known and you really don't need anybody.
I travel or when I'm working.
Well,
I don't need a retinue.
Speaking of you yourself.
I don't need a retinue or anything or guys around. I can entertain myself with a good book or a TV show or a sporting event or a concert or a show or a theater. Why do you need a lot of people?
In a career that spans more than half a century, Bing, you're in a position of mentor, in a sense, to the upcoming generations of singers and performers. What sort of advice do you offer when they ask for it?
Sing, you know, every chance you get. Just sing with groups, or in high school with the choral society, any place you can get a chance to sing. That's the soundest advice I can give. And if you ever get foot in the door, listen. Listen religiously to any advice that's given you. And if you have talent, then I think you're on your way.
tag for the shows. Bing, we've come to the end of our 50 fabulous years, and again, I must express my thanks for your generous cooperation. I know I speak for our listeners in saying that these past 26 weeks have been a major highlight in KXL's history of broadcasting, and I hope our salute to your 50 years as a recording star has been a pleasure for you as well.
It's been a genuine pleasure to be a part of this salute.
Thank you, Bing. Until we meet again, au revoir.
Au revoir.